RAC meeting for September 2019. I'm Brett Previdel, the chair of the RAC. I represent the public, and I will start at the end and let the RAC members introduce themselves.
Jeff Taniguchi, I'm with Trout Unlimited and represent Sportsman.
Brad Horrocks, Unit County Commissioner.
Big Bess.
Dan Abeda, and I represent the Ashley National Forest.
Natasha Haddon, and I represent Vernal BLM.
Mike Smith, non-consumptive.
Joe Arnold, the public.
Richie Anderson, agriculture.
I'm Miles Hammerd. I'm the regional supervisor for the Division of Wildlife.
Thank you. Our process tonight will be, for each topic, we will have a presentation public, and then we will go into comments, maybe opinions or comments from the RAC, and then again from the public. So if you wish to speak on a general topic, especially on the comment sections, you need to fill out a card, and you can just bring it up. They're out on the table, or we'll get them in here on the table. And we'll fill that card out, bring it up here, and we will call you to the microphone. Bad, so we'll give you time to express your opinion. Miles. So with that, we can go directly into the agenda. First thing on the agenda is the approval of the agenda itself. Has everyone looked at it? Okay with it? They're having a little trouble. You raise your hand so we know who made motions and who spoke. So when they transcribe the minutes, we can get it done a little better. So I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
I'll make a motion to approve the agenda.
I'll second it.
Commissioner Horrocks made the motion. Jeff Taniguchi seconded it. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, we'll proceed with the agenda. It's unanimous. Have you had any comments or changes that anyone would like on the minutes? I see none, so I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes from our last meeting.
I make a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting.
I'll second it.
Dick made the motion and Brad seconded it. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, it's unanimous. It was an interesting meeting, and the lion discussions were from one end of the spectrum to the other. And so it was very informative. So on the I'll just go through the action items that they approved. The bobcat recommendations that we approved unanimously were also approved unanimously out there. When they got into the lion discussion, the lion permits statewide, there was some very interesting testimony. On one end of the spectrum, there was the Humane Society basically opposing lion hunting. Then there was some medical doctors that testified in relation to chronic wasting disease that they felt lions were taking the sick deer and that it presented a health hazard to overharvest the lions. And then there was some sheep producers, primarily from the cash unit where we were talking about the permit numbers, that brought in documented losses of livestock, which were significant. They were losing sometimes 15 a night, and some of them had lost 100 plus sheep this year on just the grazing season. So the Wildlife Board listened to all that, and if you remember, we broke it out that the cash unit remain at 25 rather than decrease as recommended by the division. The Book Cliffs discussion was presented very well by Randy Dirth, and the board voted, I believe it was unanimously, yes it was, 5-0, to switch that unit back to a harvest objective at 29 tags. And if you remember, the division recommendation was to create a split hunt, split strategy hunt out there, and we voted as a RAC 7-2 to change it to harvest objective, so they supported that. They voted to leave the Manti Southwest unit at 18 and remain at split. There was a lot of discussion about the other Manti unit, the Southeast, and it was voted to increase that permit number to 26 on the Manti Southeast. And then we didn't discuss it a whole lot out here, but they had some sheep transplant issues on the Oker Stansberries, where they were concerned about the lion impact on the where they were trying to establish the bighorns. So they increased the permit numbers to 12 on the Oker Stansberry. And then they decreased the permit numbers on the Oker Stansberry East unit to 7. And then the rest of the packet was approved as recommended, and that included that Mineral Mountains discussion we had about the transplant area out by Delta. So it went with 6, I believe, which was the original recommendation. We had recommended 9. Then the rest of there was the discussion about, there was quite a bit of discussion about the 3-year cycle on the lion permits, which was a recommendation in the packet that we only revisited every 3 years. And so there was some opposition to that, with the interest of keeping it an annual process. And eventually it passed that we will move it to a 3-year cycle, but we will still have the numbers presented to us annually in case there's something odd that comes up. And then the only other items on there were the expo permit allocations, which was presented well by the district and passed, I believe, unanimous. Yes, it was. That's my update on the Wildlife Board meeting. Unless there's any questions on what I just presented related to the Wildlife Board, are there any? Okay. I will turn it over to Miles to give the regional update.
All right. A few things going on here in the region lately. So our wildlife section, I guess one thing we can report is, you know, that it's been kind of a dry and hot fall, but this cooler weather, I'm hearing that the elk hunting and that's picking up. This week we're starting to get more activity with elk, but before that had been somewhat limited because of the dry conditions and the hot conditions. But so I think had heard some pretty good reports personally this year from our hunters, so that's encouraging. We'll continue chronic waste and disease testing again this year, so folks can come into the office here to have their animal tested, and then we'll also be testing certain units throughout the region at our annual check stations. So that'll be forthcoming, especially during the rifle deer hunt. We'll have those check stations to do testing. In our habitat section, we have a new bio-experienced person that's come to us from out in the Utah Lake area. He's been working on the Utah Lake wetland projects out there. So we're excited to have him join our staff here in the region. Our habitat folks have been busy building guzzlers. They just finished 6 new guzzlers out in the Bookcliffs just this week. So we're continuing to be actively involved in water developments. They have some additional guzzlers to be working on. We're in the Anthro area, and they're going to do some maintenance work on some other guzzlers in the Bookcliffs this fall as well. Our habitat projects through the Watershed Restoration Initiative and in cooperation with a lot of our partners will be starting this fall. shortly. There'll be several large-scale projects to manage vegetation and try to improve some of this vegetation for wildlife and livestock and other uses as well. So a long list of projects that are available, but we're excited to have those implemented. Some of my cool things from our outreach section are Kokanee Salmon Day is this Saturday, September 14th, up at Sheep Creek. So I know the salmon are in the creek now, and they're visible up around the bridge area, up at Sheep Creek, both of the bridges. So if you have a chance, I encourage folks to come out and take part of that event this weekend. We've got a youth pheasant hunt coming up on September 28th. That'll be out at the Pleasant Valley Hunting Preserve. Some of the conservation groups, local groups, are helping put that on. So that's a neat experience for some of our youth to take advantage of. The same day on the 28th, we'll be having a sandhill crane viewing day as well. That'll be in Jensen and the Ouray area. So part of that will be dependent on where some of the birds are, but so that's another opportunity coming up. In our aquatic section, they just completed some treatments for Colorado River cutthroat, just finished the last phase of the Reeder Creek treatment. So now that's available to be restocked with Colorado cutthroat this fall. And they also completed the first phase of treatment on the north slope in the upper Carter Creek drainage. So that's all part of the effort to reestablish Colorado River cutthroat to the native range and to help show that those populations are restored and recovered to help prevent future litigation or listing decisions. So I think that's about it for tonight to share.
Could I ask you to just briefly mention the Book Cliffs Initiative, where we're at with that?
Sure. Yeah, we continue to meet as a Book Cliffs working group. We had a meeting earlier this week. Again, the focus of that group so far has been to look at the demands on the forage out there and to also look at how much forage is available. So we've been doing this forage balance. One of the big keys to doing that is we didn't understand fully how many stray horses were out there on our summer range. So we did conduct a helicopter survey of our summer range areas. We did do some adjacent areas as well, but we found that we had over 200 stray horses on our summer range. When we do helicopter surveys, there's usually a sightability index that goes along with that. We usually figure about 80% of the animals are actually observed. So if you take that in consideration, there could be in excess of 250 of these stray horses just on our summer range. And the summer range is where we believe that there's some concerns with this increased demand on the forage out there. And one of the reasons we believe that is our mule deer, as they come off of the summer range before the winter even starts, they've been in poor condition the last two or three years. Their body condition has been very limited. So it really points the finger at some issues that might be occurring on the summer range. So we're still working through that process. Right now, we're looking at it on a really good year overall in the Book Cliffs, on a good forage growth year. We're probably breaking even. On a dry year, we don't have enough forage to support the demand of the animals that are out there. We're going to be narrowing down this emphasis on this area, and we'll look to develop ways that we can offset some of these demands and hopefully spread out use and other things like that. So we have good collaboration with our livestock permittees out there, and we have representation from the ag community, so it's encouraging to have a good collaborative environment, and we hope to continue that to address some of the needs that we're seeing in the Book Cliffs.
Thanks, Miles. Does anyone have any questions related to what Miles just talked about?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. You know, which Richie maybe could even give us a little more update. I know that the feral horse situation that we've been working with and trying to address and to put some gathers together that will hopefully, you know, will get put together to eliminate that. I'm not quite sure if your survey went down on the Leota bottoms and stuff down through there.
You know, this particular survey was right out at the top of the book.
Was it there? Well, they were getting some. We met this week with the agencies, and what was they saying? How many horses were down there on the O'Ray bottoms right now? 80 head or something piling in there? Was that what it was, Miles?
Well, I think 80 on the west side of the river, and I think they mentioned the east side, they could see 125.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, I don't know how much them horses migrate back and forth, but we're trying to, with the state agencies, and Richie's kind of been the one that's heading it up down there, I guess, or helping head it up, Richie, but I don't know if he has a comment or not. But
well, we did a survey. Is Amy here? How many did we count when we did the, do you remember exactly? So we did a survey, we flew, and we did the Bonanza area all the way to O'Ray, and I think there was 300 and some horses. So we are working on that. We was going to try to do a gather in that area, privately funded. It hasn't worked out, so we're back to trying to get the state funding that's already been appropriated. We just can't get through the lawyers to get the money released. So that's really all that's holding us up. The money's in place. We just got to get through the lawyers for the state.
Okay, thank you. Dan has a question.
Yeah, so I've heard numbers for summer range, 200 to 250, and then another number that Richie just mentioned, 300 from Bonanza down to O'Ray. Do we have a current population estimate on wild horses for our region, for that, for the area we're talking about, for the Book Cliffs?
I don't believe so.
Manages them who are supposed to, and they do not have any. Their last counts, what, 12, 14 years old or something? That's nothing.
Yeah, they're over their objective number on the Winter Ridge management area by a fair amount.
There's a BLM management area for the horses.
Winter Ridge, and agents are out by agency. There's another one. There's two management areas, HMAs.
There's the management areas, which are just I won't call them small portion of the Book Cliffs because they're fairly large, but the Book Cliffs a huge area. But the majority of the Book Cliffs, and then, of course, the Ute Tribe land, are not in a management area, so they are not considered wild horses. They are considered stray feral horses.
Stray or feral.
Yeah, stray.
And if you need more information, you can call the BLM office here in Vernal, and some of the management there can give you more precise numbers or information that you're wanting to know about wild horses.
One thing I will say is we did look at some adjacent areas of the summer range on that survey, and the actual count was over 600 horses in the Book Cliffs, and that's the upper Book Cliffs, not counting Bonanza. But our focus area is really on our summer range, and that was the focus of our survey. But, yeah, we did look at some adjacent areas that may not – we really needed to know the demand that horses were presenting on a summer range, and that was our focus. But, like I say – we had over 600 head, and we didn't count most of the low areas at all. So,
and keep in mind, our Book Cliffs initiative is looking at summer range only, and we're actually narrowing that down based on some of the collaring studies on the animals, because there seems to be an area where everything is concentrating, and so we're taking that 310,000 acres that we were looking at down to about half of that. And that's what we've been doing in the group, trying to find out what the issues are. So we'll keep you informed as we move ahead with that group. We won't be meeting again until early December. Dan?
Just one more quick question, Brett. I'm not clear. I've never heard that term, stray horses. So can someone help me understand the difference between a wild horse and a stray horse?
The difference is where they're located. There's horse management areas, and then there's general BLM land. And the BLM manages them or has a objective in their horse management areas. Outside, they may have been born there. Somebody may have turned them loose. I mean, who knows where the horses came from, but they are not managed by the BLM, who is the primary landowner. and they're considered stray. Is that the correct terminology?
A stray.
Stray outside of the horse management areas, and wild horse inside the horse management areas.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
Yep. Okay, with that, we'll move into item number 5, a fishing informational item. Craig? Randy, could you introduce yourself? I'm sorry, I said Craig.
Yeah, no, that's no problem. My name is Randy Opplinger, and I'm the Coldwater Sport Fish Coordinator for the Division of Wildlife. And I'm subbing for Craig tonight. We're kind of tag-teaming the racks. This happens to be my night. But I'm going to actually give two informational presentations before I get into kind of this rule change that we're proposing with aquaponics here. But anyway, what the first one is all about, and I'm going to get some details about this, but we were tasked by the Wildlife Board last year to look at the experiences we provide our angling public and to make sure those experiences really align with what the public truly wants. So I'm going to kind of get into that here a little bit in this first presentation. But the first thing I want to do is I just want to provide a little bit of background behind what we're doing and why this is really important for us. So again, I kind of mentioned earlier during last year's Rack and Wildlife Board tour we did for aquatics, we proposed basically the removal of special fly and lure only regulations on two streams in the southern region here in the state. And the Wildlife Board did not approve those two removal changes because there was an apparent mismatch between the removal of those two regulations and what the public really what was perceived as the public really wanting. Now, in addition to that, anglers expressed some concerns during our Rack and Wildlife Board meetings over the removal of select brook trout fish, or populations and brook trout fishing opportunities in Utah. And there was also a perception that there's a need for more bait fishing opportunities on more rivers here in the state. So as a result of this, the aquatic section agreed to examine the angling experiences. So we're talking about the gear restrictions, the harvest limits, the species, and the locations we offer different species of fish on a statewide basis, and to compare them with angler preferences here in the state. Now, I'll get into this a little bit more later, but as we kind of look at the results from this, we think that there's some data that's going to come out of what we're doing. It's going to really help us address issues with crowding at fisheries here in our state. So I think all of us know that Utah is one of the fastest growing states here in the country. It's forecast that our population is going to grow from the current 3.2 million people to about 5.5 million people by the year 2050. Now, one thing that we're seeing among our angling public is a fairly stable participation rate. So if you look at the graph, kind of the red or orange line is our participation rate. So it's the percentage of people who are anglers here in the state, or I guess the proportion of people who are anglers. It looks like it's decreasing, but really it's a fairly flat line. But the population here in Utah is growing. So if you consider the population growth and take account that stable angling participation rate, what we're projecting is about a 7% increase in our licensed anglers by the year 2025. That'll be a 26% increase by 2040 and a 39% increase by the year 2050. And one thing that we know, I'm going to get into this more detail later, but the perception of crowding is one of the main reasons why anglers cease participating in the sport. So to us, really keeping anglers satisfied is really critical. So really kind of the game of this, and I'm going to get into some more details later in the presentation and some examples, but we want to begin tailoring our managed fishing experiences to meet the needs of the anglers proportionally to those anglers, starting with our 2021 fishing regulation cycle. So just as a hypothetical example, let's suppose that 20% of our anglers would prefer to fish for largemouth bass at lakes and reservoirs. Then we would strive to manage for largemouth bass if all possible in 20% of our lakes and reservoirs here in the state. And we want to ensure that anglers participate in the sport of fishing in such a way that they don't conflict with one another. That's kind of how we address the issue of crowding. One kind of concept we brought up comes out of the Forest Service, where oftentimes to deal with crowding, what the Forest Service has done is created multiple trails that tailor to different user groups. So, you know, horseback riders might be on a different trail than hikers who might be on a different trail than people who are using motorized vehicles. And all these trails might end up in more or less the same place, but by spreading those people out across separate trails, you help lower kind of this perception of crowding. And we think that we have good boat fishing opportunities and good shore fishing opportunities, if at all possible, in the same water, with the idea that there might be less conflict between shore anglers and boat anglers because they're accessing the water a little bit differently when they're out fishing. So that, kind of broadly speaking, is what we're looking at doing. Now I kind of want to get a little bit into the nuts and bolts about how we're going to go about this and present some kind of results. It's sort of show where we stand today and what we're thinking with these changes. So one thing, or the first step in this process that we want to carry out, is we want to really assess the angler preferences and behaviors. So we want to look at our angling public and make sure we have a good understanding of what our anglers really prefer and what some of their behaviors are when they're out fishing. So luckily for us, we have a statewide angler survey that we conduct every 5 years that gives us some of this information. And the last time that we did one of these surveys was back in 2017. This is a pretty scientific study. We partner with Utah State University to collect basically a large random sample of anglers across the state. So we want this to be really as objective and scientifically based as possible. So the last survey, we reached out to over 10,000 anglers and received responses from those anglers, and we surveyed in proportional to the representation among all licensed anglers here in the state, so by license type and gender. What we're kind of proposing and doing is basically an in-depth analysis of the results from that survey. And what we want to do is use the behavior and preference results to define preference groups among our anglers who seek common experiences. And I'll kind of get into this a little bit more detail later, but the idea is grouping people by anglers who fish for similar species in similar settings using similar gear might be like a group that we might define. And we also want to identify where those angler preference groups are willing to travel to find their preferred fishing experience. So are they willing to drive 2 hours, 3 hours, an hour? We don't know. We can look at the survey results and figure this out, but the idea is we want to provide the preferred experience for an angler within kind of a radius or a bubble that they're willing to drive. So after we do that, we kind of assess the behaviors and the preferences of our angling public. The next thing that we want to do is do really an inventory of the experiences that we currently offer at waters here in the state. And then after that, we want to do what's called a capacity assessment. So those capacity assessments, we want to identify the variety of experiences that each waterer is capable of providing if it was managed maybe a little bit differently than it is right now. And when we do this capacity assessment, I think there's really a lot of things that we could look at. I'm showing just a bunch of examples of questions that we could ask, and really this is just kind of the tip of the iceberg. We could ask a lot more questions than this. But for example, we can ask, does a water that's currently managed for trout have the capacity to manage for a different species like bass, wiper, or Kokanee salmon? Or could harvest regulations be modified at a water to allow for greater harvest? Or could regulations be modified at a water to create a gear specific like a fly fishing only fishing experience? Or could infrastructure improvements be made to increase accessibility for shore anglers? Or can habitat be manipulated to create new experiences at a water? Or finally, could smaller fish be stocked at higher densities to increase angler catch rate at a water it's currently managed for trophy fish? So again, those are just a few examples, but these are kind of the questions we might ask to figure out what a water is truly capable of, producing if we were to manage that water, maybe in a little bit different manner. So after we do that, the next thing we want to do is we want to identify the gaps. So a gap is just a mismatch between the angler preferences and what we're currently offering on the landscape. And we want to identify where those gaps are and where those what experiences we currently offer. And we want to use this capacity as a vehicle to basically address some of these gaps. And then, of course, in this process, we're going to probably identify some gaps that we can't currently address, and we'll have to acknowledge them in the process. And as I mentioned earlier, we want to consider willingness to travel. So again, willingness to travel is the distance that an angler is willing to travel to experience a preferred fishing experience. We want to look at where anglers' preferred fishing experiences reside. We want to determine whether the opportunities they're seeking are available in a radius that accommodates their willingness to travel. So that's kind of the process that we want to follow. Now I want to start showing some results, some of the results we have from our survey so far, and kind of what we're thinking moving ahead for our next regulation change cycle next year. So we've begun digging into that angler survey data and pulling it apart a little bit, and we've been able to identify some groupings of preferred species, preferred water types, gear preferences, and preferred access methods among our anglers. We've also looked at some of the behavioral data to look at time that anglers actually spend pursuing certain species of fish. So the first one I want to look at is our species preference data. So we've basically done a multivariate analysis that allowed us to evaluate the strength of the relationship between the species preferences to allow us to define five different species preference groups among our anglers here in the state. So what we've identified so far is that about 10% of our anglers are what we're calling lake salmonid anglers. So these are lake trout kind of anglers. They're fishing for lake trout, Kokanee salmon, or in a lot of cases of some of our kind of lake and reservoir cutthroat trout species. So these are anglers who are fishing for trout species that they really need a boat to get to in a large percentage of these people. The next group is 4% of our anglers identify themselves as warm water fish anglers. And then 8% of our anglers identify themselves as bass walleye anglers. So what we found are bass walleye are technically a warm water fish species, but when we did the analyses, we found some significant differences between people who target bass and walleye compared to all other warm water fish species. So we kind of broke those two groups apart when we did our analyses. So when I talk about warm water fishes, I'm basically talking about any warm water fish like our panfish, our catfish, our tiger muskie, our northern pike, yellow perch. We're talking about all those species minus bass and walleye. Bass and walleye are a standalone group that came out of these analyses. The next group, we found that 68% of our anglers identified themselves as stream salmonid anglers. So these are people who are fishing for trout in streams. And then finally, 10% of our anglers are what we call generalist anglers. And what these generalists are these people who don't fall neatly in any one of those other categories. They're people who don't seem to have any distinct preference, and they spend a lot of time fishing for just various combinations of these species that I listed above. So one kind of interesting thing that came out of the species preference data is we found that non-resident anglers who prefer to fish for warm water fish species seem to really like fishing for crappie. And I'm showing that in this graph over here where across the bottom I'm showing our different warm water fish species. So we have bluegill, channel catfish, crappie, northern pike, tiger muskie, white bass, wiper, yellow perch, and then the number of respondents who said they preferred fishing for that species in our survey. And we found as among our non-resident anglers, about twice as many of them preferred fishing for crappie over any of those other warm water fish species. Okay, so the next thing we looked at is preferred fishing method and setting. And we did similar analyses that allow us to find three different groups of anglers. So we found that 8% of our anglers like fishing lakes from boats, 18% like fishing lakes from the shore, and then 74% of our anglers preferred fishing by wading. And then we also looked at preferred gear. We found that 22% of our anglers prefer fishing with lures. 28% preferred fishing with flies. 46% preferred fishing with bait. And then 4% were other. And really this other, again, is kind of an equal mix of people who like fishing some combination of lures, flies, and bait. Now, one nice thing that came out of these analyses that we did is we're able to start superimposing these different preferences to get on top of each other, which then allows us to really kind of look at some of these associations and kind of group these anglers and characterize them a little bit. So I'm showing that here with a relationship between basically the gear preference and the species preference of the anglers. Now to kind of break this graph down, as you move from left to right, what we're seeing is the angler's preference for fishing in streams increases. So toward the left, you have more lake-oriented anglers, and toward the right, you have more stream-oriented anglers. And if, as you move from the bottom towards the top in the graph, we see basically the investment in fishing gear goes up, where toward the bottom you have bait anglers who are frequently investing in a fishing pole, bobber, hooks, you know, some bait. And then toward the top you have your lure anglers who are buying their rods and their terminal tackle, but on top of that they have boats and downriggers and trolling equipment and a bunch of other stuff. So they spend a lot more money to invest themselves in the sport of fishing. As we kind of break this graph down, if we look in the bottom left, what we basically find is that our bait anglers are targeting warm water fish species, or they're our generalist anglers. You move to the right, our fly anglers are our stream salmonid anglers. You move toward the top left, our lure anglers are fishing for a combination of lake salmonids and then bass and walleye. So this shows another kind of similar relationship that we're able to tease out of the data. This is sort of similar, where toward the left you have more lake-oriented anglers and more stream-oriented anglers toward the right. In this case, the bottom has less mobile anglers, and mobility increases as you move toward the top of the graph. And when we talk about mobility, what we mean is bait anglers frequently sit on a chair on the shore, and they wait for the fish to come take their bait, versus our lure anglers often move around, and they troll. They're basically hunting the lake, looking for basically the fish. So the associations we pulled out of this are basically our bait anglers are our lake shoreline anglers, our fly anglers are our wading anglers, and our lure anglers are fishing lakes by boats. And then also we looked at some behavior data. So we looked at the days that people spend fishing in Utah and other states, and we compared that between the resident anglers, which is the left graph, and non-resident anglers, which is the right graph. And what we're basically showing on the vertical axis is the number of days that people spend fishing, and then across the bottom we have our different species groups. So bass walleye, lake salmonids, the other, in this case these are the generalist species, stream salmonids, and then our warm water fishes. And there's really three take-home messages I want to pull out of this. Oh, I should point out that the cream-colored bars represent days they spend fishing in Utah, and the orange-colored bars are the days they spend fishing in another state for that preferred species. So again, there's kind of three take-home messages. The first one, if we look at our resident anglers, which is that left graph, what we find is, generally speaking, they're spending the bulk of their time fishing here in Utah. And kind of what we tease out of that is we think that we're providing pretty good fishing experiences here in the state, enough to satisfy our own anglers that really entice them to stay here in Utah to fish. Now, if we look at our non-resident anglers, what I've kind of done is I've circled the warm water anglers off to the right. And what we see is these warm water anglers actually spend disproportionately more time fishing in Utah for warm water fish species than in other states. And then the third one is if we look at our bass walleye anglers, we find that they're spending disproportionately more time fishing in other states for bass and walleye than they are in Utah. And I'll kind of break those two down a little bit in a minute and talk about some of the implications we think for that. But what I want to get into is what we can maybe do using these results. Again, this is just kind of the beginning of the analyses. I'm just showing you the tip of the iceberg, but we think there's a lot that we can do with this data. So the first thing that we can consider is potentially some changes in our regulations for certain species of fish. And there's really a lot of different regulations that we can consider, but one I'm just going to show as an example that kind of sticks out are our crappie regulations. So one thing we know is that our non-resident anglers seem to seek warm water fishing experiences more in Utah than they do in other states. And these non-resident warm water anglers seem to really like fishing for crappie. Those are the two kind of take-home things we get out of that. So that tells us that potentially if we were to consider liberalizing our crappie regulations at some of our waters, it might help increase non-resident angler use of crappie here in the state. Now, another thing we can consider are changes in how we manage the species just wholly on a statewide basis. And again, there's a lot of things we could look at, but one that really sticks out so far is our largemouth bass and walleye management here in the state, where again, non-resident anglers seem to seek bass and walleye fishing experiences more in other states than they do in Utah. So that tells us that we probably need to examine our largemouth bass and walleye management efforts here in Utah and compare it to other states and see if there's some things that other states are doing that we can adopt here that might improve our management of these species and make these species more lucrative here for our anglers and also for these non-resident anglers. And we think that improving our management would help attract more non-resident anglers. And on top of that, of course, you know, these fish are here in Utah, so to provide a side benefit for our anglers as well. And then the third thing we could consider are changes in how we manage access and amenities at our waters. And one example that really sticks out for us is shoreline angler access. So one thing we know is that anglers who prefer fishing for warm water species are more likely to fish from the shore using bait. And we also know that these anglers are more likely to keep fish for food and prefer fishing at locations that have good amenities like restrooms and fish cleaning stations. One thing that we do acknowledge is broadly here on a statewide basis, there's a lack of developed shoreline angling access at our warm water fisheries here in Utah. And as a matter of fact, we know already that outside of our community fisheries, there are no fish cleaning stations tailored to the needs of shoreline anglers anywhere here in Utah. So we do have fish cleaning stations, but we often put them on boat ramps, which are great for boat anglers, but we don't necessarily put them in places that have good shore fishing. And that's something we could consider down the road. So we know that improving our shoreline angling opportunities will address the needs of what appears to be an underserved portion of our angling public. So I just kind of want to sum things up by talking about where we plan on going from here. So we're just starting to dig in to the analysis of that statewide survey that I was talking about. And we want to continue digging into that survey over the next year and evaluate preferences of our anglers and group our anglers from that survey data. We also still need to examine the willingness to travel component of that because, again, what we want to know is how far anglers are willing to travel because we want to replicate certain fishing experiences enough over the landscape that anglers don't have to drive beyond where they're willing to travel to find their preferred fishing experience, at least wherever possible. We still need to inventory the experiences that we offer at our fisheries here in the state. We still need to do a capacity assessment of how we could maybe manage our fisheries differently to provide different opportunities for our anglers. And we still need to look at how we can modify the management of our fisheries where needed and feasible to meet the needs of our anglers. And then again, we need to still address the gaps with the creation of new angling opportunities here in the state. Now, on top of the statewide attitudinal survey, we also have a statewide lapsed angler survey that we're sitting on as well. A lapsed angler is somebody who used to be a fisherman, used to buy fishing licenses regularly, but no longer purchases fishing licenses for whatever reason. And we want to dig into the results of that survey to see if there's any information that we could pull out of that that would also kind of provide similar benefit and help us tailor the management of our fisheries here in the state. And then what we're basically proposing to do is incrementally propose data-driven regulatory changes between 2021 and 2029 to address the gaps that come out of our analyses. And we'll do this in two-year intervals because that's when we do our regulation changes for aquatics, is on a two-year cycle. We also plan on continuing to survey our anglers at five-year intervals using the same survey methodology that we've been doing so we can adapt to changes in angler preferences and behaviors and changing habitat conditions and increased demand over time. And then also we want to do some follow-up surveys. So that's really just a broad summary of what we're looking at. I'm more than happy to take questions, but I thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you, Randy. Are there any questions from the RAC?
I have a few.
Jeff has a question.
So when do you expect the data to be processed and all this stuff?
Our goal is to have regulation changes basically to present in front of the RACs and Wildlife Board a year from now. So if you kind of backstep from that, I think our goal is to maybe have these analyses and the kind of some conclusions wrapped up probably around the 1st of April next year. That gives us time to kind of go through our regulation change cycle and start really considering what we're doing.
Okay, I've got several questions. You know, when you talk about a two-story fishery, and there's got to be a cost to the DWR. For example, if you have a lot of bass in a lake, you're going to have, and you want a two-story fishery with trout, you're obviously going to have to plant those fish larger, and that's an added cost to the division. Is that something that is a concern?
We'll have to evaluate that when it comes up. You're right. You know, we might have to plant fish at a larger size, but I think we might also find results that kind of counter that as well coming out of the survey. For instance, we know that historically we've seen more interest in warm water fishes here in the state, which typically we don't stock. In a lot of cases, we let them naturally reproduce and just kind of run their own with some management input from us. So we may have to stock larger trout, but we may find more interest in other species that naturally reproduce and other things that maybe kind of help offset the cost and allow us to provide more opportunities for our
anglers. Okay. So does the division actually manage individual waters, or is it kind of a blanket approach to most of your waters, say warm water fisheries, say you take Steinecker and you take Starvation? Are they managed differently on a water-to-water basis?
To the best of our ability, yes. So, I mean, we monitor our waters individually, look at the results of those monitors.
I understand that, and I understand that the 22-inch size limit for most of the slot limit fish are kind of broad so that, you know, there's no confusion with law enforcement. But I'd kind of like to see the division relook at that and do that per waters. For example, on the Green River, the slot is great. And, you know, I just think that some waters may need to have a different look on that. That's just my opinion. So I'd like to ask a question. What are the crappie lakes in Utah? You said that it's a pretty popular fish, but I know we've got them in Red Fleet, and the verdict's still out on how they're doing. Is there some other waters, and is there some other planned waters to supply that angler need?
We haven't planned any additional waters yet, but, I mean, broadly on a statewide basis, I don't know how many crappie waters we have. It's not as many as, say, trout waters in the state, but, I mean, we do have a respectable number of crappie waters. So,
the other question I have is, I served on the Blue Ribbon Fisheries Advisory Council, and we did a survey on that committee on how much it generates local communities. And I'm just wondering if the division with this master plan has it tied in to how much money will be generated for local communities. For example, Daggett County probably relies a whole lot on the Green River for a lot of their income as far as, you know, recreation. And, you know, I'm just saying, and if you look at southern Utah, 90% or a great portion of it, from my understanding, are people from Nevada that are accessing Utah waters in southern Utah. And that's a huge, I guess, boost for the division when you've got Nevada paying for licenses in Utah to fish. And, you know, I guess that kind of has to figure into the equation a little bit, in my opinion.
I think it will figure in the equation. I know what survey you're talking about, and it provides us great results about the economic input that some fisheries have to their local community. And, you know, we haven't got as far yet as looking at specific regulation changes yet, but I think when we get there, we're going to have to take that into consideration.
Okay. I would really be interested in what you find in your data. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Is there any other questions? Dan?
Yeah, Randy, can besides like Lake Powell and some of those other reservoirs, Quail Creek, Quail Hollow, or is that the name of it down in near St. George? Besides some of those reservoirs, do we have many true warm water fisheries in the state? I mean,
not a terribly large number of true warm water fisheries. We have a lot more kind of two-story fisheries and a lot more cold water fisheries in the state.
Sure.
We'll have to look at that more over time, I think. You know, looking at just trends in the survey, we're seeing increased interest in warm water fish, which I think is really going to make us step our game up a little bit and maybe manage some additional fisheries and look for some additional opportunities in the state.
Willard Bay is another strictly warm water, I believe, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Highly popular, Willard Bay. Any other questions from the rack?
Yeah, maybe Joe? Real quick. So the fly fishing portion of the streams, it looks like, do you anticipate seeing, and I know it's hard to tell, seeing a certain, like a river that would be sectioned off to fly fishing only? Because mostly it's flies and lures in most of our rivers. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. And we'll have to dig into the results a little bit more. We haven't quite got far to figure out, you know, separation, say, between fly and lure and understanding the preferences. And again, you know, I think also we're talking about incrementally making changes over the course of, I don't know what it is, 7 or 8 years, something like that. I think some of these we're going to have to draw the public in a little bit and probably do some additional follow-up surveys to help kind of fill in the gaps to make sure we're making well-informed decisions. So I think where we are right now is I think we're going to pull some broad conclusions out and maybe some things that are safe things that we know we can make some changes right now, and then we're going to have to probably look a little bit harder at some other changes that are going to be teased out of this as well to make sure we're making the right decisions.
How are you?
Thank you.
Good.
One more comment. I love the way that the DWR is doing these seminars on wipers, on walleye, and on different species. I think that you guys should realize that I think that's a really wonderful thing for generating the next generation of anglers. I may represent Trout Unlimited, but I was a tournament bass fisherman in a different life, so I understand both warm water and cold water species, and I understand how important it is to bring that next generation of anglers into the fold so that we can get them off of computer games and get them on something real. And so I'm 100% hats off to you guys for those kind of seminars that you guys put on.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the public? Could you come up, Scott, and state your name?
Thanks. Is this turned on?
Yes.
And now I knocked it and it's going to fall over. But anyway, I got a couple of questions, and I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Scott Chu. I'm here as Representative Scott Chu, and also a landowner. But on your surveys, I was really interested in the part where you had the circles and showed that different groups kind of fit together. When you were asking your survey questions, did you happen to have an opportunity, some way to differentiate the difference between the people when you asked the questions if they went fishing? Did you ask if they specifically went fishing, or did you ask if they just happened to be fishing? Like what I'm getting at is in my relatives, my in-laws, grandpa really liked to fish, and his kids kinda did, and the grandkids don't care so much. But when they have a family reunion and it happens to be up on the mountain, everybody has a fishing license, and they'll go fish in the streams, perhaps. And I just wondered if That just looks like another piece of information. If you knew if people were specifically going fishing or if they were going fishing as a part of another activity. Did you have that in your questions?
Yes, we do. So we've got some information on other kind of activity preferences among people. And I think that's another draw-in that we'll kind of pull in eventually would be, you know, do our anglers typically prefer, you know, X, Y, and Z for other kind of activities? So we've got that in there. We haven't teased it out yet, but we've got data.
So did it fit in on the different types, the stream, the lake, the shore? Did it fit in those?
It's not going to fit in those because the questions we asked are really, for the most part, preference questions. So, you know, okay. Hypothetically, if you're going to go fishing, would you prefer, you know, fishing on a stream or fishing on a lake? Those kinds of questions were the type of things we asked. And then the other questions are, you know, what are your preferred kind of other recreational activities in addition to fishing?
Okay, well, I appreciate that. I'm quite interested in some of those kind of surveys. My other question is, you talked quite a bit about managing the waters, and I'm curious, what do you mean by managing the waters? Are you talking about just managing the species of that are within the waters, or are you talking about actually managing the water?
We're talking the species primarily. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, regulations for species we stock. We could do, you know, various amenity kind of improvements. We could do habitat improvements. To get the water question, you know, as a division, we're not the ones that usually manage the water, but there are situations where there might be water issues in a water or prevent a fishery from maybe reaching its full potential. And whenever possible, we'll work with the appropriate people to help make the fishery better from a water perspective.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Okay, since this was an informational item, we're nothing to vote on, and we're going to move right into the next item, which is the private fish ponds rule amendments.
Okay, so I'm actually going to do one more informational topic, and then we'll get into the aquaponics one. Okay. So this one, the other thing we're kind of talking about is some things that we can do to simplify issuing of certificates of registration for fishing tournaments here in the state. So what I'm going to go into is just kind of what we're looking at implementing here in the next year or so, just to make the process simpler for the angling public. So broadly, what I want to start with is just talk about what a certificate of registration is and kind of our process for issuing certificates of registration. So a certificate of registration, or it's going to be written as a COR throughout this presentation, is a special permit that covers certain wildlife-related activities. We offer CORs in the aquatic section, for example, for people to have sport fish species in a pond on their private property. That's one example of a COR that we offer. Or the focus of this presentation is going to be on fishing tournaments, where in a lot of cases we're asking for a certificate of registration or a COR for a fishing tournament to be conducted. But basically, people who want to participate in activities that require a COR currently have to apply for their permit using a paper application they download from their webpage. So they basically download it from our webpage, print it off, fill it up by hand, and then mail it or drop it off at one of our offices. And these applications then are reviewed by regional and Salt Lake Division personnel and then approved or denied on a case-by-case basis. Broadly speaking, though, the public is pretty dissatisfied with what they view as a flawed COR process within the division. I think some of it's because it's very antiquated, where we're asking for paper applications and we now live in a pretty electronic age. And some of it also is just the time it takes for us to review a COR. Admittedly, for us within the division, the review of CORs is a pretty time-consuming process, and it's pretty common to have a backlog of CORs that are waiting for approval. So what we want to do is we want to create basically a more modern, more efficient COR application process. And I'm going to focus today on the fishing tournament COR, but honestly, we're looking at a similar process for all CORs on a division-wide basis. The fishing tournament COR is sort of a low-hanging fruit. We think it's one of the easier ones to implement, so it's going to be one of the first ones that kind of gets this updated process. So as we look at an automated fishing tournament COR application process, what we really kind of see is an online portal It basically asks people questions, and it provides the people, as they answer the questions, guidance to their eligibility of their COR request. And we kind of envision a system that basically kind of takes our current rule into consideration and looks at their responses and kind of compares them with one another. So currently, within our fishing tournament rule, we've got various rule requirements related to aquatic invasive species or AIS certification, number of participants in the tournament, tournament prize values, whether or not the tournament has a live weigh-in, the species that the tournament is targeting, and then also the adherence to the fishing regulations at that water that the tournament's being held on. So another function that comes out of the fishing tournament COR is we want to try whenever possible to prevent scheduling of multiple tournaments on the same water at the same day. What this does is it brings, if there's multiple tournaments in the same water same day, just a lot of anglers at the water, creates a lot of crowding, and it creates a lot of conflict with non-tournament anglers who often don't know a tournament's going on. They show up to a water and find that there's just a lot of people there. So an online application would help address this conflict by not allowing tournaments to occur on basically specific days, like holidays, free fishing day, a location or a date that's been determined by us within a division or other managers, because these tournaments are often held at places like state parks, to be ineligible for a tournament, or a date or a location. Look at our current rules for the fishing tournament COR, and it would basically provide guidance to those applicants regarding the eligibility of the request based on those rule requirements. So what we've kind of worked on is an online portal that people could use for applying for a fishing tournament COR. We're in the very early phases of developing this online portal. I'm going to show you just kind of a mock-up of how it's going to work to kind of show what the functionality will look like once it's fully completed. But the idea is people will get onto our webpage, and if they want a fishing tournament, they would be brought to basically a page that asks them just a handful of just screening questions. These are questions that really are the core ones for evaluating whether the rule requirements are met and to see if there's any kind of conflict on dates with a tournament. So it's going to ask whether the contestants are fishing from a boat, whether there's a live weigh-in for the tournament, if there's going to be tagged fish required for the tournament, how many contestants are going to be involved, what the cash value of the prizes for the tournament is going to be, and what the tournament start and end dates are, and what water body that tournament's going to be at. And I'm going to show four different scenarios that could come out of the responses of these questions. So the first one I'm going to show is what we call a date collision. A date collision means a tournament that somebody's proposing is on the same date as another tournament's being held. So if people answer those first questions, in this case we're saying hypothetically, they're saying they're going to be fishing from boats, they're not going to have a live weigh-in, they're going to have 120 contestants, there's going to be $2,000 of prizes, and they're going to have the tournament on July 6th and 7th of next year at Electric Lake. Now, in this case, it's going to bring up a notification. It basically says that you need authorization from the Division of Wildlife. That's based on comparing the rules to some of those criteria that they entered. And it's also going to point out that they chose Electric Lake, but it's already reserved for another tournament in this scenario I'm showing. So it's basically going to ask them to select a different tournament date or another water body for their tournament. And it's going to provide an option for them to see a list of tournament reservations. So the idea is they could click on that list and see other tournaments that are scheduled in the state so they can maybe select another water body or another date to hold their tournament. So it'll bring up a table, basically shows water body, dates, the organization that's holding the tournament, and whether it involves tagged fish. Our idea behind showing the organization that's holding the tournament is there might be some opportunities when somebody clicks and they see a particular organization holding a tournament to maybe negotiate with that tournament for a date swap or something like that to make the tournament happen. So that's the first scenario. So the second scenario I'm going to show is one where you need a COR for the fishing tournament. So in this case, we're going to stick with Electric Lake, but they've switched the tournament dates to August 6th and 7th the next year. When the system looks at kind of the criteria that they entered, it's going to find, based on our current rules, that basically a COR would be needed for that fishing tournament. So it's going to bring up a page saying you need a COR, please complete the registration and the tournament guidelines, and then you're going to pay a $10 registration fee. And then what it's going to do is it's just going to walk you through a process to finish the steps up for getting your COR. So the next page it would bring up is kind of a more complete page asking for contact information for who the tournament director is, who the sponsors are, the species of fish they're targeting, what the entry fee is, whether they're allowing pre-fishing, and where the weigh-in locations are going to be on the lake. So this is going to ask for just some more detailed information on that fishing tournament. When they press continue, one stipulation of a fishing tournament is they have to complete kind of an aquatic invasive species certification form. Currently, that's a paper form, but we're going to bring it online and allow people to sign for it just on the web page. So that would be sort of the next thing that's brought up. next thing is they'd go to a payment portal where they pay their COR fee for that fishing tournament COR, so it would all be handled online. And then after that, they would basically be brought to a page saying, here is your COR, and give them the option of basically printing off their COR from that computer right then and there. Or we can mail them a paper copy. I think they'll have a choice of which option they prefer. But if you kind of run through this, instead of us reviewing paper applications, there's a potential here for a computer system to do this automatically and for you to basically complete your COR for a fishing tournament. And I don't know how long it's going to take, but probably in 10 minutes or less. Okay, so the third example I'm going to show is one where you don't need a COR. So in this case, the contestants aren't fishing from a boat. They are going to have a live weigh-in, but they're going to have 49 people, $500 of prizes. The tournament's going to be held on May 6th and 7th of next year at Deer Creek Reservoir. And basically the premise behind this is when the system looks at our rules and looks at what they entered, they'd find that basically based on the number of contestants and the prize value, they wouldn't need a COR for this tournament. And it basically just bring up a message saying you don't need authorization from the Division of Wildlife from this tournament, just go ahead and have it. And then the last example is a tag fish contest. A tag fish contest is when somebody on the first screen basically selects yes for they want tag fish for that contest. By our rules, there can only be one tag fish contest on a water in a particular year, and the Division of Wildlife has to be the one to put the tags in the fish. So basically, if you select yes to that, you're brought to a page that brings you the contact information for the regional aquatic managers, and you reach out to the person who's in the region where you want to hold that tournament, and you'd have to talk to them and set up getting that tag fish tournament to happen. Okay, so that, broadly speaking, is kind of what we're looking on for this online portal. So what we anticipate is activation of a functional application portal probably sometime beginning of 2021. In addition to creating the portal, what we plan on doing is creating a monthly report that would be posted on the division webpage that would just show the tournament dates and locations so people could see before they go fishing where tournaments are going to be held. And then also more than likely next year when we come out and do fishing regulation changes, we're going to bring forward a fishing tournament rule modification. Historically, the fishing tournament COR was designed to prevent overharvest and mortality of stockfish, but we don't find any evidence that fishing tournaments are actually having a biological impact here in the state. So we're probably going to tweak the rules a little bit and bring a proposal out next year that would basically meet with the modern angler and kind of manager needs. So some tweaks to the rules. So I'll thank you for your time again. I'm happy to take questions on this one if you have any.
Are any questions related to this last topic?
I'm sorry to be a pest, but I've got a few questions.
Jeff, go ahead.
So this is not in place right now.
That's correct. It's not.
Okay. Okay, that's a big one because we just finished our single fly on the Green River, and I wasn't aware of this, but I assume it's going to be something in the future. The other thing is, are nonprofits going to be part of the whole thing also? For example, all the money that we generate from the single fly goes right back into the Green River system. And we bought Ryan Mosley a new generator. We did the signage on the Green River. We do the boot washing stations, those kind of things. So I assume that nonprofits are not exempt.
You know, honestly, I don't have an answer to that. I think it's going to kind of be the same way as it has been historically. We're just changing how you apply for a COR. But what I could do for you, Jeff, is I could look into that a little bit more and get your response.
The other question that I have is a division taking advantage of some of these tournaments by collecting data?
The answer is we have in some cases. So we started working with some tournaments to get some information from the tournaments on just numbers of fish caught and things like that.
Okay.
We don't do it for every tournament, but we're doing it with an increasing number of tournaments.
What do you assume the fees will be and the enforcement?
Fees for the COR?
Uh-huh.
They will remain the same as far as I know that they've been.
I'm not sure what that was.
I think it's $10.
Oh, okay. That's pretty nominal. And is there active law enforcement on how these are conducted?
The enforcement would remain the same as it's been. So really the only thing it's changing is just how you apply for the COR. The rest of the kind of the nuts and bolts behind the COR, the rules, we're not proposing any changes at this time. So again, it's just the application process that's changing.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? I have one quick comment. When you get it electronic and they adapt that to the other court COR permits, they do not notify people on expiration and renewal. The district loses a lot of money with permits lapsing, that if they would just send out an invoice, people would renew their multi-year cores. If you could pass that on somewhere along the...
I'd be happy to pass that along.
You just have to basically start over, and you're on your own.
Yeah.
And they're five-year cores, and they're kind of hard to remember 5 years from now. So with that, we will...
Could I ask one other question? And I'm sorry I didn't bring this up earlier, but I know that burbot are a big problem in Flaming Gorge, and the Burbot Bash is a Wyoming Trout Unlimited kind of a event. But is a division, I guess the general rule is if you tag a fish on a fish that is designated a catch and kill, is there an exemption or something of that nature that is given? I mean, for that's the prime example that I'll give is the Burbot Bash, because they have the tag burbot in, and if you catch one, you get, you know, this prize or that prize. So I'm just trying to clarify for the division's sake, because that's one of the things that I hear all the time is that, you know, it's a catch and kill fish, but they're catching them, tagging them, and releasing them. So I just want a clarification on that.
Yeah, maybe you could chime in this a little bit more, Trina. But I think broadly speaking, you're right. We're putting a fish that has a catch and kill back in. But I think what our feeling is that by putting that fish back in and creating a contest around it, we generate enough publicity.
And I understand that. I understand that 100%. And it's for the resource. It's just I hear that so often that, you know, it might be something to address on this is why we're doing it this way.
I think broadly speaking, you know, we could work with outreach a little bit, and when these things come out, let people know this is why we're doing it, and we're able to greatly offset those tag fish released by additional harvest of fish for creating a tournament.
Thank you.
Let's deal with this in when we have regulations. Rather than at this time, let's explore that option, and we'll note that, Jeff. But let's address that at the appropriate time. And it's a good to know we have a loophole, and it'll be documented in the minutes. And then when we address rules related to the burbot or fishing tournaments, or when would that be a good time to address that, or do you wish to address that now?
Well, our plan is to bring fishing tournament rule change out next year, so it might be the time would be a year from now.
Okay.
We'd have an opportunity. To
And you'll make a note that
I'll make a note. We'll consider those things as we kind of revise
okay.
the rule.
Okay. Thank you. Do you want to roll into the next topic?
Absolutely. Okay, so this is my last one for the night. So this one actually is a recommended rule change. So what we're basically recommending is a change to our private pond rule, which is R-657-59, that would provide some circumstances where aquaponics facilities can operate without a certificate of registration. Before I get into the nuts and bolts of that, what I want to talk a little bit about is the Private Aquaculture Advisory Council. It's the PAAC. I'm going to call it the PAC throughout my presentation. But what it is an advisory council that was established by the Utah legislature back in 2017. It's a 10-member council that has members that are private aquaculturists, private pond owners, anglers, representatives of the Division of Wildlife Resources, and representatives of the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. And one goal of the PAC is to give advice and recommendations to the Wildlife Board on rules adopted concerning the regulations of private fish ponds, private stocking, short-term fishing events. The PAC also advises on the aquatic animal species authorized for importation or use in aquaculture facilities, fee fishing facilities, private fish ponds, short-term fishing events, and private stocking. So one topic that came up at a recent PAC meeting was aquaponics. So aquaponics is something that's increasing in popularity, not just here in Utah, but I think nationwide and even worldwide. And unfortunately, aquaponics is not addressed under current Division of Wildlife rules. So what we've traditionally done is we've handled aquaponics facilities the same way that we'd handle a private fish pond under a private pond rule. So again, that's R-657-59. In reality, however, an aquaponics facility is pretty different than a private fish pond. Aquaponics facilities have really a much lower fish escapement risk because most of them are what we call closed-loop systems, meaning they're indoors, they receive water from a culinary source, that water is discharged into a sewer or septic system. And in comparison, a private fish pond is an outdoor pond that frequently has some kind of connectivity to a public waterway. So given that, this lower fish escapement risk, what the PAC recommended was the establishment of some criteria where aquaponics facilities can operate without a COR. And they tasked the Division of Wildlife for basically coming up with some rule language, and we did so, and that was approved by the PAC, and that's the language that I'm bringing forward tonight. So what we're recommending is adding some language to R-657-59 that establishes criteria for when an aquaponics facility can operate without a certificate of registration. So we're recommending that no COR is necessary provided the aquaponics facility is what we're called a hobby operation. So that could be either for personal use or there's some provisions under the rule change that we're proposing to allow schools to have aquaponics facilities without a COR so they could provide it for educational value within the classroom. Next off, the facilities have to be closed loop. So as I talked about earlier, that means they're indoors. They have water from a culinary source and that water is discharged into a sewer or septic system. Next, all applicable fish health rules have to be followed when importing fish. Fish also cannot leave the facility alive, develop lists. So if all those criteria are met, then an aquaponics facility can operate without a COR. I just want to show you that fish species list real fast. I just want to point out that this is the correct fish species list. I think the RAC packet that was sent out a couple weeks back had one species that's not included under what we're actually proposing. So this is the correct list. So it's got bluegill, hybrid bluegill, specifically the cross between bluegill and green sunfish, red ear sunfish, green sunfish, striped bass, white bass, hybrid striped bass or wiper, largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, channel catfish, yellow perch, fathead minnow, black crappie, white crappie, rainbow trout, cutthroat trout, brown trout, brook trout, tiger trout, walleye and golden shiner. I think that's 21 different fish species. We selected these species because these are species that all have naturalized populations here in Utah. So if they were to escape from an aquaponics facility, it wouldn't lead to the establishment of a new species of fish here in the state. And on top of that, there's health certified sources for all these fish. So these should be fish that are fairly readily accessible to an aquaponics facility if they wanted to put them in their facility. Now, in addition to those fish species, we included also all other species that are considered non-controlled for importation and possession under our collection, importation, and possession rule, which is R-657-3. I don't know how many species that includes, but it's probably hundreds or thousands of additional species that, in theory, could be raised without a COR, provided all those other criteria are met. Now, we did bounce fish species list across some representatives of the Utah's aquaponics industry. And they came back and they proposed adding jade perch, sleepy cod, and tiger shrimp to that no COR species list. We had some discussions with our fish health people, some aquatic invasive species people, our sport fish people, and our native fish people, and we decided not to add those species to the no COR list. And basically our rationale behind that is there's no escape wild populations of these species here in the United States. So if they were to escape from an aquaponics facility here in Utah, it would lead to the first populations of these species here in the United States. And we also know that based on the biology of these species, in principle, they probably could survive in some habitats here in Utah. Next off, these are species that have been raised in aquaponics facilities in other countries, and they've escaped some of these facilities. And they've had some detrimental effects on native fishes in these other places. So they are considered an invasive species, so it makes us a little concerned about having them here. And then finally, they are known carriers of diseases that threaten both cultured fish and hatcheries and also wild fish populations. So we didn't add them to the no COR species list, but the one thing I want to point out is there's still an opportunity for an aquaponics facility to apply for a COR if they want these species. And if that's granted, they could go in and have those species. So broadly under this rule, we're just kind of proposing some criteria where no COR is needed, but CORs will still be available and granted when the aquaponics facility is not a hobby operation, so that would be, in this case, a COR from the Department of Agriculture. The facility is not closed loop. When some of the fish health rules cannot be met, and the fish will leave the facility alive, and the fish species raised is not off that list that I presented a couple slides back. Now, one thing I also want to point out under this rule change is currently there's some fish species that are prohibited for possession here in Utah, and you need a variance from the Wildlife Board to actually possess those fish species, and we're not changing that. So those prohibited species would still require a variance under what we're proposing. So broadly speaking, that's the rule change that we're proposing. Now, and then what we're asking for tonight is basically a vote on these fish or this particular criteria that I just brought up. Now, one thing I just want to point out is this is our last RAC meeting, and we've kind of received some input from other RACs that are making us think that maybe before we go to the Wildlife Board, we might make some just subtle tweaks to the rule that we're proposing. I just kind of want to highlight those just so you're aware of how things might change before they go to the Wildlife Board. So the first one is with the definition of aquaponics. We might narrow that definition a little bit in the rule to basically specifically state that aquaponics is for the production of agricultural products. So we're pulling out any kind of distinction where people might think that they could maybe have a fish display tank or something like that and call an aquaponics facility. And the next one is we may need to include a reference to our existing collection, importation, and possession rule. So it's R657.3 that regulates the possession of fish outside the species covered under the proposed aquaponics rule. So I just want to thank you for your time tonight. I also want to thank the PAC for their input on the recommended rule change and the Utah aquaponics industry for their input on the species list. And again, I'd be happy to take questions if anyone has any.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the RAC?
I have a question.
Yes.
You know, I seen that you had cutthroat trout on that list, and yet the division has spent tons of money on trying to restore pure strain cutthroat into their original ranges. Is that a concern with the cutthroat being on that list?
I think in this case it's not a big concern to our standpoint, and it's really because, again, these are going into closed loop facilities where basically they're getting a culinary water source and all the water is going into a sewer or a septic system. So if fish were to escape, it wouldn't really have anywhere to go.
So these are basically only on the closed loop systems.
Exactly. This is just okay. For closed loop systems.
Could you please stand up and tell us your name, please?
Hi, my name's Amadeus Guy. I was just wondering if those closed-loop systems would be inspected.
They would not be inspected provided all those other criteria that I presented are met. Now, if they're not met, they might be subject to some kind of inspection before we would approve those facilities.
Yeah. Thank you. Are there any other questions? We have no comment cards from the public. Are there any comments from the RAC? Okay, I would entertain a motion if someone would like to make one on this presentation.
I propose to accept the presentation as presented here tonight.
Natasha makes that motion to accept as presented.
I second it.
Jeff would second that motion. All in favor? 9 in favor, no one opposed. Thank you, Randy. Appreciate it. I'd like to take a moment to recognize Jamie, representative from Ute Drive, that's joined our meeting. Thank you, Jamie. And with that, we will go into our last item. Remember, members of the public, if you want to comment, we need a card. So if you think you're going to comment, fill one out and bring it up, please, on this topic. You will be able to ask questions without a card.
Okay.
That's Jace.
Right? Working right there.
Jace, would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure will, yeah. My name is Jace Taylor. I am the bighorn sheep and mountain goat biologist for the Utah Division of Wildlife at a Salt Lake office. So what I'll be presenting today are the bighorn sheep unit management plans. You might remember that last year we brought around a bighorn sheep statewide management plan that was approved through the RACs and then through the board that was approved back in November of 2018. The difference between the statewide plan and the unit management plans is that the unit management plans get into more the details, the site-specific hurdles or obstacles or goals that we have for each of our bighorn herds. And so we get more specifics. It helps us be more, as our biologists, as they're making management decisions, guide them in those directions that are specific to that area. The reason why we're bringing these around right now is because when that statewide plan was approved, there were some changes in it that needed to be reflected in the unit management plans. And so that's what we've done now. We've updated the unit management plans so that there's nothing that is inconsistent with the statewide plan. It's worth noting that prior to now, these unit management plans have not been public documents. They've always been internal documents that the DWR has used to make management decisions, like I mentioned earlier. And we haven't made changes to population objectives or things like that, but we feel that it's important to take this opportunity to bring them out, make them public, get feedback from the RACs and from the board and from the public, to be as transparent as possible, help everyone know what we're trying to do, what our goals are, and then also get the input that'll help make these plans as strong as possible. So we're really excited to bring these to you. Look forward to your input, and we're excited to do this. The unit management plans, after they're approved here through this RAC and board process, would not be represented unless there's a significant boundary change, a change in the population objective, or if there's a new unit that's being proposed. All other changes will be approved by the DWR director.
Can I interrupt for just 1 second? We would like to go through this entire presentation, and then if we have issues with an individual unit, we will bring them up at the end. Perfect. So if you have questions that you need clarification, go ahead and ask them, if that's all right with Jace, during. But we want to try to get through this and then go back and revisit items.
If you guys want to do that, that's fine by me. So there are 19 bighorn sheep herds or bighorn sheep units in the state. 18 of them are being presented now through this process. The one that is not was the Mineral Mountains. It was presented and approved by you back in May of 2018. When we did it at that time, there was nothing that contradicts the statewide plan. And so there was no reason to bring it back around. So all 18 of these are the ones that needed to be updated, and so that's why they're coming to you now. Of the 18, there are 11 Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep units and then 7 desert bighorn sheep units for you guys here in the northeastern region. We have the Uintas, we have the Aviniquin, and then portions of the 9 Mile would also be here in your district, and I guess the Bookcliff South as well. So, as I mentioned, these unit management plans contain a lot of specifics for the area, but they also reflect the overall goals, our overarching objectives for the state, like we mentioned in the statewide plan. Some of them are worth noting here, so I wanted to hit those. The DWR's overall objective is to expand bighorn sheep populations where feasible and to maintain bighorn sheep on a sustainable statewide basis. Also, the DWR will not manage bighorn sheep to the involuntary exclusion of domestic sheep. Some of you know, and we'll get into a little bit later on, bighorn sheep take a lot of intensive management. There's a lot of risk involved with having bighorn sheep, and the DWR recognizes and accepts that risk, and so that's an important note for all these plans. DWR's goal is to manage for healthy populations of bighorn sheep that provide quality opportunities for hunting and for viewing. Then getting into some of the specifics, we have each plan will have a population goal and objective. Essentially, the number of animals that we are hoping to manage for in that herd. Those objectives can change over time, even within a single site, based on a number of factors. Some of those factors, things like human development, fire history, so a fire could also open up more habitat for bighorn sheep, water availability, and then risks of pathogen transmission. And we'll have a slide here that gets a little more into that. But essentially, it's important to remember that these things can change as what we feel is available, suitable habitat that's appropriate for bighorn sheep to occupy. If you take all of these 19, the 18 that we have here, plus the Mineral Mountains, the statewide objective is 9,025. And currently, our population estimate is 4,150. This is what that looks like on a graph. The 9,000 number there in red, and then the blue line, what we've had in bighorn sheep growth since 1996. So you notice from that last slide and this slide that we are half of what our objective is. Some of those objectives are a little bit lofty, and part of that has to do with the struggles that these herds face, and oftentimes it's respiratory disease or it's available habitat. And so we'll kind of go into that. But one thing I think is worth noting is that in the last 22 years, we have been able to double our bighorn sheep population in the state, something we're proud of, and that we hope that we can continue to expand when appropriate. If you get into each unit, This table will explain the objectives and the current estimate of abundance. So the first column there is the unit, second being our population objective. The last one is our most current estimate of abundance, right? So as you look through these, a couple of things that are probably worth noting. See the number 125 in a number of places like Antelope Island, Nebo, Pilot Mountain, and then some of those other units that could be broken down into subunits. We oftentimes use this 125 as a minimum viable population number. It's a number of animals we like to have in a herd at a minimum to have enough animals to avoid inbreeding. So we hope that having a population of 125 allows for enough genetic diversity that we can avoid that. Another thing you'll notice throughout these is that, like I mentioned, there are subunits in some of these. And then also a lot of them are well below their objective. And the most common limiting factor for these herds in our state is respiratory disease. You may know respiratory disease is common in bighorn sheep herds, especially when they contract pathogens that they have not evolved to be able to live with. A number of our herds here in the state struggle with this. And so each of these unit plans goes into what is important and how we can avoid and limit respiratory disease in our herds. Common things that you'll see are we're striving for spatial and or temporal separation. This is separation from animals that we feel carry the pathogens. So most commonly that's wild bighorn sheep populations that have suffered from respiratory disease. And then also the current science tells us that domestic sheep and goats are also likely carriers for these pathogens. We also think it's important that we employ emerging technologies to strive for our separation, and also that there are technologies that will help us to treat these herds that struggle from respiratory disease. We also think it's important that we support voluntary win-win agreements. Those are agreements with individual livestock operators who are willing voluntarily to help manage in ways that provide spatial separation. Sometimes that can mean conversions of allotments or transitions from some species from one species over to another. But it's important to us that those are voluntary situations. That's the only way that we'll have support in our state, and we feel that support is important for the future of bighorn sheep management. Also, it's important that we remove bighorns or stray domestic animals that pose threats of transmission. If a bighorn sheep leaves an area that we feel it's safe from avoiding these pathogens and heads into other areas, we oftentimes remove those animals. And the same thing happens with. I also think it's important that we manage for density, sex ratios, and age structure that will minimize wandering events of bighorn sheep. We'll have a slide here in a minute that will kind of get into how we do that. And the last thing is that we sample all of our bighorn herds on kind of a rotational basis where we go through each, catch animals live and sample them, and have a sense of what pathogens exist in those herds. And we get through each of our herds once every about 5 years. Another important part of these plans are the habitat objectives. Overall, it is to maintain or improve bighorn sheep habitat to enhance individual herd success. The unit management plans get into the specifics about water improvement projects that could be done, you know, in this drainage or this guzzler project, fire management that would help improve or maintain bighorn sheep habitat, and then, like we talked about earlier, spatial and or temporal separation. Then also the plans get into the recreation objectives, which are to increase public awareness and education while working to expand opportunities to view bighorn sheep. And then also we think it's important that we increase hunting opportunities as the populations allow while maintaining quality hunting experiences. All the unit plans reflect the statewide plan that we now offer we offer permits on 12-25% of the counted rams or 30-60% of the counted rams that are 6 years or older. Those counted numbers come from our surveys. Surveys are either done from the ground or from helicopter every 1 to 3 years. That's how we get those most current population objectives and also how we base our permit numbers among a number of other things. With those numbers, you could argue that Utah is now perhaps the most aggressive state in the West or across bighorn sheep habitat when it comes to ram hunting. We feel that's important. We think that gives us the best opportunity to reduce the chance of wandering events. We feel that by having lower ram densities or lower ram to ewe ratios, younger age structures of rams, all those things may help us providing incentive for rams to wander. We feel that there's potential when a population has too many rams or there's too many old rams. Young rams do not have breeding opportunities, so therefore they are incentivized to start leaving, and that's an important thing for us, a tool that we're trying to use. We also think it's important that we explore hunts with variable season lengths, dates, and weapon types. and then also that we explore using female-only hunts when needed to address density or abundance concerns. So these are populations where they're reaching their population objective, they don't feel comfortable transplanting out of that population. So you'll probably see that in some places we'll start using these female-only hunts. That's everything that I have. Thanks for your time, and look forward to the input.
We received the sheep management plans in the packet, and we also received some comments via email. So let's address the email comments first, just so we make sure we all got them. There was one from Uinta County Commissioners in Wyoming. Is Commissioner Horrocks, is Uinta County the where Evanston is?
Yeah.
So the corner there.
Evanston.
Yeah. Very corner of Wyoming. And if I, it's a full page, but if I may sum it up, they were very complimentary of the working relationship with the DWR and the fact that, that they were taking into account the trying to come up with win-win solutions, as you said, with the livestock producers. And so the last sentence is, based on this, the Uinta County supports this management plan, which maintains the current permitted sheep grazing along with the bighorn sheep populations. So that was pretty much just a letter of support. Then we
comment on their letter?
Yeah, let me go through these three, and then we'll go to comments from the RAC. We received a letter from a livestock producer and husband and wife livestock producer, and they did not, if I can sum it again, and if I missed something, feel free when we talk about comments. They had a concern specifically with the Antelope Island plan that it had mentioned that the, Chase, did you see this letter?
Is that Scott Stubbs?
Yes, it is. They had a concern, you had the problem on Antelope Island and had to depopulate it. And the plan, don't let me misquote it, but the plan said something about there was an assumption that maybe they'd caught that from domestic source. And they had took exception to that comment and sent a letter saying that they didn't want that to be part of the plan. So is that an accurate way to?
Yeah, essentially the Antelope Island State Park, or the Antelope Island Unit Management Plan says that in November of 2018, respiratory disease was detected in the herd, that we had to depopulate the herd. You remember hearing about that. And then it goes on to explain how we felt that that happened. And we do mention that potential for commingling or contact with domestic sheep and goats. But we do also note that we do not know for sure how it happened. And so the request from Scott Stubbs, and then from there we kind of go into what steps were taken to prevent that kind of commingling. So in the context of the plan, that's why it was written that way. The request is to remove, because we don't know for certain what happened, to remove the language about domestic sheep and goats, which was asked of us at the Southern RAC, which is where Scott's at, and then the Southeastern RAC last night. That's a fair request. We do not know for certain how that happened. In the context of a plan, it was written that way to explain steps that we're taking and why we think that we can reduce this chance of something happening in the future. But I think we can do both without saying things that we don't know are for certain.
Okay.
Those are fair comments, and those both passed in the previous RACs, and we're comfortable doing that.
With that comment, okay. Natasha, you received an email. Is that, do you want to make that public?
Sure. So I received an email from a BLM wildlife biologist from the Salt Lake Field Office. She had some concerns about the Oker Stansbury West unit, and so I'll just express some of the concerns here and questions she had. So she commented that there doesn't seem to be a conclusive analysis on why that population was extirpated in 2016, and so she's wondering if the conditions have changed or if anything has changed to help prevent that from happening to the new population in that area.
or no, great question. So so this is kind of the opposite end of this, the same spectrum, where maybe too much detail in one plan about the event and the depopulation and maybe too little detail on the other end. So we're always trying to find the right spot. And yeah, we've talked about that for this, for that particular plan. We probably don't have enough language in there talking about that, and we'd be happy to bolster that to help explain what we think happened. But more importantly, the steps that we have taken to help reduce the chance of that happening again in the future.
Okay. Another statement she talked about was Muskrat Canyon. Is identified in the unit plan as a priority site for habitat improvements and water improvement projects, but much of that area falls within the North Stansberry Mountain Wilderness Study Area. And so some of those projects she's concerned might not be consistent with the BLM policy for wilderness study areas, such as like restrictions of vehicle access, predator control, and even installing new guzzlers for the habitat improvements. And so she just wanted to make that known that that could be a concern there.
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is we talked about habitat improvement projects or water improvement projects. We identify specific places. One of the places that the bighorn uses Muskrat Canyon, but it is, a lot of it is in a wilderness study area. And so, yeah, I think we could, we definitely don't have any plans of doing anything that would be out of line with the BLM policies in those areas, but we could do a better job of, I think what Nancy's after is more verbiage saying that that we do want to cooperate, you know, and work collaboratively, that we won't pressure the BLM to do things outside of their policy. We'd be happy to make that more clear.
Okay. In relation to the habitat projects and water developments that are needed for that area to support the bighorns, she has concern about the population objective being 500, and just wondering if that's a realistic objective with the need for the habitat management projects and water development, especially in relation to the management plan that it identified in that area that there's for a maximum of 120 bighorn sheep for the public lands and the Forest Service lands in the Stansberry Mountains. So I don't know if that's based off of AUMs, that 120 that was previously identified.
I think what Nancy's talking about is a different analysis that was done previously. I'm not fully up to speed on it or really familiar with it. I think that's when we did to sit down and look at that other analysis. In the plans, we do outline how we model habitat. Maybe this would help a little bit if I throw up one of these. I guess I could actually go to the one we're talking about. But these, in each of the unit management plans, there are these maps that have the unit boundary and then also kind of an orange-yellowish color that is a modeled suitable bighorn sheep habitat. And that model runs, a lot of that has to do with the ruggedness of the terrain. More rugged terrain is more suitable typically for bighorn sheep. And then also the kind of cross-hashed color there is for what is currently occupied. So most of the units have more habitat than what is occupied, and sometimes that's, most of the times that's by design. We don't necessarily want to have bighorn sheep throughout all that habitat. But here this is the Oker Stansberry West, or the Stansberry Mountain itself. So what, in the unit management plans, we describe how this model is run that gets at the amount of suitable habitat, and then we also talk about what we feel is a suitable density for the habitat that's available. The Oker Stansberry West has about 115,000 acres of modeled habitat. Some of that we do not feel is appropriate to have bighorns in at the current time, but with that 500 number and that number of acres, that's a density of about 1.1 bighorns per kilometer squared, which is kind of on the lower end of some of the guidelines that we manage for. But again, like I said, we're not intending to use all of that, so it's probably closer to two, half of that habitat we're not planning to use. So that's kind of how we did that. And I think if we wanted to go more into depth, that kind of thing, I think we could do that with communication and try to figure out.
Yeah, that might be a good idea, because I don't know. I know, like, in our resource management plans, there's a lot of AUMs for livestock and for wildlife, and so I don't know if this increasing it by 500 would require a increase in AUMs for wildlife in that area.
That's something that we could.
It might be something that needs to be addressed. So yeah.
We could work together on that and see where we're at. But.
Thank you. Questions? That's our emailed comments. Questions from the rack.
You know, Mr. Chairman, the letter from the Uinta County Commissioners in Wyoming. What is substantially what they're saying here, that this pathogens are also found in other wildlife species such as mountain goats, white-tailed deer, mule deer, caribou, moose, and antelope and bison. Is that a true statement?
So current research and historic research up to this point has identified wild bighorn sheep and wild mountain goats as capable of carrying the specific pathogens that we are most worried about, and then also domestic sheep and goats likewise. There is recent research that has found these pathogens that we're talking about in other species, the ones that are listed there. Some of that has not been cross-validated. Some of it's really new research, and I don't know that I would be at the point, not currently at the point where I would say that it's conclusively found in all those species. I will say that some of it has been cross-validated. Caribou was on that list. Alaska Department of Game and Fish feels confident that they have these pathogens we're talking about in caribou. And even though, like I said, it's new research, that doesn't mean it's wrong. And we are interested in finding out more about this. And we have, in the recent captures, started testing for these pathogens in other animals like deer. Antelope Island's probably a good example. We have plans to test bison, deer, and pronghorn before we reintroduce bighorn sheep. So we are interested in it. But as new as it is, I wouldn't feel comfortable saying that that whole list is something that we necessarily agree with. But he is not incorrect in that there is recent research.
You know, and, you know, it seems like it's, I don't, you know, say that we're not, you know, well, I'd like to see, you know, you take with Stubbs' comment here, you know, it seems like we sure like to jump to all conclusions and say it's, you know, it's domestic sheeps. So I did a little calling with this one email we all received, and it seemed to be that it was pretty prominent in white-tailed deer, mule deer, you know, it seems to be, you know, but I just, you know, I'd like us to do some, you know, research on this stuff, and, you know, it we all need to work together. I like his email letter, you know, let's all work together, but I'd like to see us try to leave out in some of our wording that all the blame is on domestic sheep. You know, if this, you know, let's all work together on this. I think the division's plan is great, you know, with what they've come up with last year, but it's, you know, let's just substantiate some of this stuff before we, you know, I'd like to, you know, I just did a couple of phone calls, and I guess it's pretty common to claim in South Dakota with the mule deer and whitetail.
Yeah,
if that's the case, I would suspect they're carrying it here. I don't know.
It would depend, you know, I guess, who you asked, how common it is or how definitive it is in those species.
Yeah.
I think that the level of research that's been done currently, at least the DWR's position, is that we cannot say definitively with those particular species whether it does or does not. But we are definitely not going to put our head in the sand. We're spending quite a bit of money to go capture, I think it's a total of 120-ish. Let me think. I guess it'd be about 100 bison, deer, and pronghorn on Antelope Island. I mean, that's a fair bit of money that we're spending on that. I definitely agree. We are interested in learning more about this. It doesn't do anybody any good not to understand it fully, and so we are interested in understanding it better. And I really appreciate both the Uinta County, Wyoming, for sending their letter, and Scott Stubbs as well. We work closely with Scott. The region here has met, you know, over the years multiple times with some of those grazers from Uinta County. I think that we have a great relationship. We're very excited about working together. I think that we are working together, and we are intending to do our best to understand these things better. But I think that the current point, you know, where we stand is different, but that's okay. We're all interested in working together to do our best to understand this as best we can and have the most number of a balanced acorn sheep and domestic sheep in this state. So we're definitely committed to that.
I have a question related to the mountain goats. How does the path, if they're known carriers, does it affect their population, or do they die from it?
That's a good question. So they are carriers of some of these pathogens that we're talking about, but we have not seen the same response in mountain goats that we do in bighorn sheep. They seem to be better suited to be able to handle these pathogens and not have the same kind of mortality rates. But there are, have been some places, and maybe it has more to do, maybe it has to do with, you know, levels of stress, maybe habitat issues, but there have been places where mountain goats have died from respiratory disease believed to be caused by these same pathogens. We don't think we've seen that in Utah. But I'm talking about some, a couple of very few instances that have happened in Nevada and other places. Rarely it has, but it has been documented. We haven't seen that in Utah yet. We do test our goats.
Are they a concern in the high Uendazan as a pathogen carrier?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we recognize is that there's potential for them to carry it, and we have, like I said, we do test them for it. And just recently in the last year, I think there was one animal from
the East
Unit. Iowa's East Unit that did test positive. So, yeah, there is potential for that.
Thank you. Other questions? Yeah. Dan?
Yeah, Jace, you mentioned briefly about minimum viable population. Mm-hmm. Could you expand a little bit more? We, each unit has a population objective, but if you could maybe talk about the relationship between that objective and minimum viable population. And I know that, you know, in these unit plans and the statewide plan, there's no discussion about MVP, minimum viable population. Could you expand on that a little bit? And maybe I'm interested if numbers are going to come back into these sheet plans, these unit plans or statewide plans, as far as minimum viable population.
So maybe I think we're using the word maybe a couple of different ways, but the way that we intend to use it here for these unit management plans is that we are striving to have a minimum of 125 animals in each population to allow long term to have enough genetic diversity and mutation, basically, that we would long term not end up in a genetic inbreeding situation. So that's something that we strive for. Sometimes we're capable of doing that, sometimes we struggle to do that. And then there's, that's what we strive for, self-sustaining. But we recognize with bighorn sheep that it's a heavily managed species, that there's other ways that we can manage them maybe more intensively provide that sustainability, whether it's, transplants that bring in some new genetic material, some other things like that. But sustainably wise, we would strive to have 125 long term.
Per unit, then?
Yeah, that's...
And does it actually say that in... I haven't seen that anywhere. Is that...
Yeah.
Is that in the statewide plan?
No, I don't think that the statewide plan doesn't get into any of the numbers of the unit management plans. Within the unit management plans, I think, so if you looked up some of those ones we mentioned, like Antelope Island, Evo, they may get a little more specific and talk about striving for a minimum sustainable number of 125.
I see. And then did you mention that this is the first time that these unit plans have come through the RAC process?
Yeah.
Okay.
These 18, yes.
Yeah, okay.
That's it for questions.
Or any other questions, and then we will have a comment period after.
I do have a question.
Jamie?
So on your, 9-mile unit, the change, what are the changes? Is it boundary changes on those? I mean, we get the maps, but we don't see them compared to what was in place before.
Good question, yeah. No, 9-mile, no change to the unit boundary. So it's actually... Or there's two subunits within the 9-mile. You have like the Jack Creek and then the Great Canyon. Same unit boundary that there was previously, the same one that we use on like our hunts. So same unit boundary for those two subunits. Same population objectives for those two. There were not any major changes to that one, which is honestly the case for most of them. The changes would have been things that changed in the statewide plan that needed to be updated in the unit plan. So things like the permit recommendation guidelines. Some of our language is a little bit different, but no, Jamie, the boundary and the numbers are the same.
Okay, is that the same for Aviniquin? Is there any boundary changes there?
No, same boundary for Aviniquin, same objective. Dax could do better talking about that one.
Hey, I'm Dax Mangus, the Regional Wildlife Manager. So, Jamie, I, just be clear, a couple years ago we did change the boundary for like that Jack Creek hunt that includes like the Willow Creek area. So I didn't know if you were asking about that or not, but that did change a couple years ago. It's not changing now, like this plan that's come through. That's been in effect for a couple years already. So, but other than that, no boundary changes to the Vinequin or that 9 mile unit. But a few years ago we did change the boundary for the Jack Creek hunt to include the Willow Creek.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman, are we going to go through the each individual unit? We're not going to go through.
No, we have them in the packet. So if you have questions related to an individual unit, I'm sure Jason
can
call it up.
Okay, I misunderstood. I thought he was going to go through the each unit, and then we were going to have questions. So okay, I don't have a question, but I will have comments later.
Okay. Are there any questions? Are there any more questions from the RAC? Okay. I've got the two comment cards, and we'll address them later. Do we have any questions, any clarification issues that you need from the public? Okay. We do not have any, so we will roll into comments from the RAC.
I've got a few comments. And
this is Richie speaking.
Glad to see a few, Representative Chu here as well, but just to kind of reiterate what Commissioner Horrocks said, I think we need to be careful on the speculative language because, you know, the language was put in there on the Antelope Island that it could have been caused from domestic sheep or goats. That was speculative. The lake would have had to have dropped a great deal for that to happen. But we're not putting in the language on the other wildlife possibly carrying the pathogens because that's speculative. So we need to just be careful of the language. I mean, if we're going to determine one thing speculative and not put it in a plan, let's not put other things in there that are speculative. So on the Antelope Island deal, do we need to make a motion, or when we make a motion to pass this, do we need to make a motion that language be struck, or are you just going to take it out?
We will make a recommendation as a RAC.
Okay.
After the comments, what we will typically do is, if we have specific issues with any of this plan, we will make motions directed at them specific issues.
Okay.
And then I'm assuming at the end we will approve the remainder of the plan as presented after we express concerns or desired changes. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you. And then, excuse me, we had a few concerns. By and large, I don't think there's a lot of concern as far as the objective numbers. I hope we can reach those. And so in that way, as far as the species and the introduction or reintroduction or the increase in objective and the species itself and the habitat, I don't see much concern with the proposal. We had a few concerns on language again, and it's just really simple stuff. It's a matter of taking a sentence out, adding a sentence. The first one was on the 9 mile unit under the potential threats to habitat. The last sentence in the second paragraph said there is, however, potential that, well, I need to read that whole paragraph. It says significant oil and gas leases have been approved and developed on bighorn sheep habitat near the Jack Creek area. Most of the proposed and developed wells are in flat areas above good bighorn habitat. There is, however, potential that these areas could be abandoned if disturbance is excessive. So while there may not be a concern with the habitat or the species in that area, and I've explained this before, but I'll kind of explain it again. Very seldom do we have trouble with the wildlife or the habitat. It's radical groups that will use species to hinder development or economic growth or anything that they deem not appropriate. And so we have to be careful of the language that's used, that we don't give them fuel, I guess, or something for a judge to look at to create an injunction, say for an oil and gas lease. Our problem with that last sentence is who determines what excessive is? What excessive disturbance is? I mean, does the DDWR determine that? Does the BLM determine that? Does Wild Earth Guardians determine that? Does SUA determine that? It's just, that leaves the door way too wide. We'd like to create a situation where, in the language, it's pretty definite that the DWR is proposing these objective increases or whatever. Know that, and the DWR knows that this activity is going to take place, and the DWR believes they can work with those entities to manage any concerns. I think that needs to be in the language so that we create the perception that, hey, the DWR, as wildlife managers, we believed, we knew this activity was going to take place. We felt those numbers were still appropriate, and we can work with that. But not have language that could be interpreted by, and if it was litigated, a judge would have to determine what excessive is. And so what we'd like to do is we'd like to take that sentence out, that last sentence, just take it out. And then we could add something to the effect, the language could be determined by other people, but just an idea would be instead of that last sentence, take it out and say, though there may be increased oil and gas development in this unit, the DWR believes the oil and gas industry is willing to help address issues that may arise. The DWR will work to foster a positive relationship with the industry to mitigate bighorn issues. Say something like that. So you're saying, we know there could be some possibilities, but we can handle it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, as far as the question goes, yeah, that makes sense. And you know, if you guys choose to make a motion and pass it, that sense, I think that we'd be willing to work with the interested groups to find a wording that would. I think we could find a wording that would meet the needs of both groups and work obviously with the biologists in the area, but we'd be willing to work on it, I should say.
Okay, we'll make that motion later. This was supported by the UNA County Commission as well as Scott Chu and I believe Ron Winterton. Would support. Okay.
Okay, so we can address that. Did you have any other specific issues?
Yeah, I do. Just on the UNA unit, just another sentence change, just one sentence. So I'll just read that first paragraph under the same section, potential threats to habitat. It says, human disturbance can result in abandonment or degradation of bighorn habitat due to the rugged nature and lack of roads near sheep habitat, human disturbance of bighorn on the unit is expected to be low. If disturbance becomes an issue, UDWR will work and support federal agencies, BLM, U.S. Forest Service, on travel management plans and other land use plans. Furthermore, the public will be made aware through town council and other local meetings in an effort to get local support to reduce human disturbance to bighorn sheep. Bear Top will remain closed to motorized vehicles to reduce human disturbance. So in the second to last sentence there, it says, furthermore, the public will be made aware through town councils and other local meetings in an effort to get local support. What kind of reduction in human disturbance is, because we talked about travel and management plan up above, what kind of human disturbances would the DWR be lobbying to, or what kind of reduction in human disturbances are we talking about? Are we advocating to close roads, possibly? Are we advocating to just create, you know, let people aware, hey, stay out of this area because it's hurting the bighorn sheep? I'm confused on what you would be promoting to reduce human disturbances. I mean, my whole experience with bighorn sheep is primarily desert bighorn around the Lake Mead Hoover Dam area when I was a kid, but and those things are all over the parking lots and right around Hoover Dam and boat docks, and they don't seem to care much. But my point is, what would the DWR be advocating in a way of reducing human disturbances? And so that language to me So if we just took out, furthermore, the public will be made aware through town councils and other local meetings. If we just took out in an effort to get local support to reduce human disturbance, if we just took out that part and put in if, just put in the word if. Furthermore, the public will be made aware through town councils and other local meetings if human disturbance to bighorn sheep becomes an issue. And then we could put in the DWR recognizes they, there may be circumstances that require increased human activity within bighorn unit to properly manage lands and resources. The reason I'd like that sentence in there is maybe you're aware, maybe you're not, but there's a lot of other, there's other state agencies as well as our national representatives such as Senator Lee and Representative Bishop that have been working very hard to get increased access to for land managers to get into some of these areas to manage vegetation, watershed issues, so we don't have the catastrophic event we had like in Dollar Ridge. And so without adding that sentence, you're almost counter to what other state agencies and our representatives are trying to promote, you know, because it sounds like you will be trying to lobby for reduced human activity, and sometimes that may be something you'd have to do, but we got to be careful that we don't give these other groups ammunition to use against what other state agencies and our national representatives and politicians are trying to accomplish, because we do need to access these areas and manage those resources. And so I would like the DWR to put language in there that says, hey, we recognize this stuff's got to be managed, and so there's going to be need to be an increase of access at times, but we know that we believe we can handle it and we can mitigate it. Does that make sense?
So again, we can address that with a motion if you wish to make that. So did you have anything else on your list, Richie?
No.
Okay. We've got any other comments from the RAC? Okay, we've got two.
Randy, I do.
Okay,
yeah,
Dan?
I've got some comments here for you, Chase. of course, you know, our concern is reducing the risk of contact with bighorn sheep in the High Uintah Wilderness, as we have. You know, I think there's 7 or 8 domestic sheep allotments up there. And so things like, you know, habitat improvement projects, we would want to make sure that those projects are encouraging sheep to go the other way, so to speak. You know, that's a concern that we have is we would like to see that, you know, as those projects are planned, that the division works closely with the Forest Service so that, you know, we're not encouraging, you know, more, you know, interaction between bighorn sheep, say from the Hoop Lake herd, the Sheep Creek herd, you know, going to the High Uintah Wilderness and commingling with domestic sheep. So that's one comment. Another comment would be the possibility of, and I think this is consistent with your plan in terms of, you know, providing, you know, hunting opportunities, looking at some potential opportunities to maybe rethink and adjust hunting boundaries. Specifically, this is would be on the north slope. I think moving, not looking at a regional boundary as, you know, the reason we draw lines on hunt boundaries. Again, to discourage wandering rams from going up into the high country and putting a little pressure, a little hunting pressure on these bighorn sheep. Again, not thinking that you know, we can't, because I know that, you know, with the Aviniquin unit and the Nebo unit, that's one hunt boundary, correct? So there's, you know, it wouldn't be setting any kind of a precedent. I mean, on the north slope again. And I mentioned, you know, I appreciate your comment about minimum viable population. I, you know, as we, you know, as with bighorn sheep being a Forest Service sensitive species, and you know, just a species of conservation concern for both the state and the Forest Service, and having domestic sheep allotments and that interaction, that potential risk of contact, having a number to kind of hang your hat on with for bighorn sheep would be helpful for the Forest Service in terms of managing those domestic sheep allotments. And so that's something that I wanted to just go on record as to say for the Forest Service. And we really appreciate, you know, all the support that we've got from the local, the regional fish, the regional wildlife biologists, Amy and Randall, just to mention a few. We've appreciated, you know, the support that we've received from them and helping to try to manage this you know, bighorn sheep, domestic sheep issue that we have on the Ashley. So, okay.
One comment. I would respectfully say that, you know, our representatives are elected officials, but there are a lot of people who have different opinions on that. And I would just like to express that differing opinions is what's going to make this council an effective council.
Thank you. That's Jeff that made that comment. Okay. Scott, would you like to address the group?
Thank you. Yeah, I've got a couple of things.
State your name, please.
Scott Chu, and I'm here, like I said before, as a state representative for District 55, and at which is all of Uinta County and a portion of Duchesne County. I've heard from a lot of constituents. I know time's short, so I'm going to try to express the two concerns I put on the card. One of them is similar to or fits in with what Richie was saying about. And at the first of the meeting, we had a really good example of we need to think a little broader, and we've got experiences here. We've got a horse issue, and part of that issue it came about because of the ability of other groups to take the law that we created with the Wild Horse and Burro Act and manipulate it. And I think that's what Richie was trying to say, is we don't want to create something here that allows a group that doesn't have any dogs in the fight, you might say, to keep us from reaching our objectives. And so that was one thing. But the other thing that really, really bothers me is not necessarily the fact that fingers are pointed at the domestic sheep, but we had an incident last year on Antelope Island, and I'm very disappointed in the way I've expressed my disappointment to the state people. We had a herd on, a bighorn herd that was pretty much an isolated herd, that isolated as far as we know, and they showed up and they disappeared, they died. And a lot of it, we finally figured out that it was respiratory problems. We had 23 survivors, is what I've heard the numbers were. And our policies and what we do is we look at them as carriers, not as survivors. We look at them as carriers, and we eliminate them. In the livestock business, we look for traits that are superior, and we try to breed for that. And I'm very disappointed to think, and I would like to encourage the RAC to be a little more broad-minded in these instances. We had an opportunity that we'll never see again in our lifetime. Those sheep that were there, possibly, we have a lot of testing capability now we never had before, that we could have maybe they were packing a gene, or maybe there was something there, and we've missed that. We've eliminated that trait by not being broad-minded about, hey, wait a minute, we've got an isolated herd. We've got some survivors. Let's see why they survived. If Alexander Fleming hadn't looked that second time at that bacteria sample and come up with penicillin, how long would we have been before we'd have had that opportunity. Anyway, I just feel bad to think we might have missed a golden opportunity. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you. Jerry?
My name is Jerry Allred. I'm a local sportsman, and I love wildlife. I love to go to the mountain and see critters. Bighorn sheep is an iconic wildlife species, and was shown that the objective is considerably higher than the current population. I'd like to ask the RAC to do all they could to improve bighorn sheep so we have more bighorn sheep and more hunting opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Okay, with that, what I'd like to do is take motions for changes in this in these management plans specifically, and then, as I said, if we have, we will vote on each change. There's probably not a large number, half dozen or whatever we have here, and then afterward, I am assuming we would pass the remainder of the plan as presented if there's no concerns. So I will open it up to the board to make motions, specific issue motions. Let's not group them.
I'd like to make a motion that the DWR remove the antelope island language, speculating that the disease was transmitted from domestic sheep.
Richie made the motion.
I'll second it.
Brad seconded that motion. Motion was to remove that specific language related to the suspicion that the Antelope Island problem could have been from domestic livestock. Is that correct?
Sure.
Okay. All in favor? Appears to be 7 in favor, all opposed. 2 opposed. I've been told process-wise I should ask those opposed if they want to state why they're opposed, and you have that opportunity now, or we can just move on, whatever you prefer.
I'll go ahead and just say that I think there's pretty strong evidence. It doesn't actually come right out and say that that's what caused it, but I think that the evidence is strong enough that I'm comfortable with that language in there.
Okay. That motion passes 7-2. I will open it up to any other motions.
I'd like to make another motion on the 9-mile unit plan under potential threats to habitat to remove the last sentence in paragraph 2. There is, however, potential that these areas could be abandoned if disturbance is excessive. I'd like to make the motion to remove that sentence and add a sentence that would express the DWR's confidence that they can handle habitat issues that may arise.
And if I just want to make sure, I want to clarify that, Richie. You're just talking about the abandonment, not the fact that oil and gas may disturb. It's just the abandonment sentence, correct?
Correct. And we're mostly concerned about the word excessive, but okay. That whole sentence would
excessive
need to be
disturbance and abandonment
would need to be
one
removed.
Sentence.
Do you want me to propose a sentence to replace that, or
Dax?
Well, if you had a, you know, trying to UDWR will work with land management agencies and oil and gas operators to avoid potential impacts to bighorn sheep through mitigation measures.
Would that be sure. acceptable to replace that? Strike that sentence. Dax, go ahead.
I hate to interrupt you, but just so you know, the exact same language is also used in the plan for the Book Cliffs rattlesnake. And I think you might want to include that same change in language there. And I actually had a sentence written to add, and it's basically exactly what Commissioner Horrocks just
okay.
said, that we would work cooperatively with energy developers and land management agencies to implement appropriate mitigation measures to minimize any impacts. And I think that's something the division is committed to, and that's typically what we do. And
okay.
I just would maybe suggest you might want to add the same change to that Book Cliffs rattlesnake plan as well.
Appreciate that.
I would open the. We have a motion on the floor. I would open the opportunity to amend that motion if you would, and yeah. add.
I'd like to make a friendly amendment if Richie would consider maybe adding that language, as we said, including the Book Cliffs unit, and that the UDWR will work with land management agencies and oil and gas operators to avoid potential impacts to bighorn sheep through mitigation measures. That would be a friendly amendment, I guess, Richie, if that's
perfect.
So we have an amended motion. I'm looking for a second.
I just have a quick question, sorry. Are there, Dax, do you know, are there any other units that has that have that same language? Are we just talking about?
Those are the only two that I know of. And those plans were written by our southeastern region staff. They are the ones that actually do the management in that portion of the 9 Mile and that portion of the Book Cliffs. And I think those are the only two that include that.
Yeah, I checked that earlier today. Those are the only two that have that.
Thank you.
This unit's the units that's going to have the larger energy development potential.
So we have a motion from Brad. Do I have a second?
I'll second that motion.
I have a second from Dan. All in favor? That would be unanimous. Is that correct?
There
was no opposed? Okay. That passes the wording on the oil and gas. Passes 9-0. Okay, do we have any other motions?
Jace, did they make any motions for the Ochre Stansbury units in any of the other RAC?
No motions were made, but comments were
okay.
taken. And we
that you would adjust those?
Yeah, I think, we're more than willing to work on those, and I think that we would be. Maybe it might be safe just to go ahead and make a motion that we do something to the effect of would like us to look at the wording. It might
okay.
be safe to make a motion.
Okay. Then I'll make a motion for the Ochre Stansbury West unit to look at the two, let's see, to put wording in there to better describe the steps that were taken to address why the population was extirpated in 2016, and then also talking about how you will work with BLM when looking at doing habitat improvements and water improvements in the wilderness study area, and then also to perhaps better coordinate the objectives, the 500 bighorn sheep set, and look at the resource management plan that had a maximum of 120 bighorn sheep set for the Stansbury Mountains.
Okay, I think Miles has that written down.
Sorry, it's kind of long.
We have a motion from Natasha.
Miles, reinstate that motion.
You're going to have to replay the tape.
Was it kind of wordy?
No pressure here.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Could we?
You really want that read?
Do you want me to break it out?
I am sorry. I need to. Yes, I apologize. But
okay.
I would.
Okay, I'll break it out. Okay. So for the Ochre Stansbury West unit, the DWR needs to add language about how the steps they took to address why the population was extirpated, and so that does not happen to the new population, or potentially does not happen to the new population.
Okay.
That will be my first motion.
Okay.
Is that?
Yeah, maybe some clarification would help. So, the history of the Ochre Stansbury herd is that we started that herd. We reintroduced bighorn sheep to that area in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
The population grew to about 230, 250 animals. And then it was, I think it was the winter of 15-16 is when we had a severe die-off. 90% of the collared animals died. And then we decided to go in and depopulate, lethally remove the rest of the animals. And then we took some steps to help prevent them contracting respiratory disease in the future, but those steps are not necessarily, they're not laid out in the unit management plan. And I think what Natasha is asking is that we write down what those steps were taken.
I'll second that motion.
Okay, we have a motion And we have a second by Brad. All in favor? That passes unanimously.
Okay. My second motion is for the plan proposes the Muskrat Canyon as a priority area for habitat improvement and water improvement projects. However, it is a wilderness study area under the BLM resource management plan. So I propose that DWR put wording in there that they will coordinate with BLM and their policies to address those when proposing habitat improvements and water improvements projects in that area.
Could we add a comment in there? You know, if it could work with the county's RMP, county's resource management programs. I don't know if that would be adding too much, but or not, if we could add that in there just so they'd, the county that is involved in would be, you know, would be looking at their RMP, you know, their resource management plan program or not. Is that, be included? Basically, including the county, the RMP, to be in this process. I don't know.
You're talking about for Muskrat? You're talking about Tooele County?
Yeah. You know, I just to make sure that the county would be included in there.
So we have a
comment. Let's just leave it at a comment.
Just leave it at a comment? Okay. You'll just take that. Take a note of that?
I would second her motion, though.
Okay.
You know, but I didn't know if she wouldn't mind reinstating that the comment was that, the county RMP would be included in that, if that would be appropriate or not.
I don't know the situation out there on BLM land in Tooele County, so.
Well, we all have the resource management plans that we are all putting together with wildlife management, range management, in our counties, and it's kind of nice to include the county's RMP resource management plans process with, we're doing it with the Forest Service, we're doing it with the BLM, DWR, and a lot of manners that's, we're just to be included in that motion.
Natasha, or do you want that motion modified by Brad? Are you in?
Sure, you can add that.
Okay. And I'll second. Is that how the process goes? If that's okay for her to accept that.
Okay. You're okay if it's in there, Natasha?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. So a motion by Natasha, second by Brad.
Can I just ask a question? Does that not happen normally? I mean, are we splitting hairs on something that usually happens with the agencies and we're asking for something that's really already happening?
So we're talking about two different things, right? So we do coordinate, cooperate with BLM and the Forest Service, the land management agencies, and that's an important part of any habitat project. I think that if you could recall, I'm trying to think when it was, Marty came around and gave a presentation talking about the county RMPs.
Marty Forrester?
Marty Bushman. Marty Bushman.
Bushman.
No. Governor's office that works over with the liaison with the DWR. So you could remember, if you remember back to that presentation, I think that's probably a good source of, I don't know that I'd be best fit to try to explain our position and where we stand with that. That I hate to just defer you to look back on that, but that's probably the best I can do unless there's somebody else that thinks they could do a better job describing that.
Dax Magus, Wildlife Manager. I guess I'd just add really quick, just for clarification, and I'm joking right now. Unfortunately, just because it's in a DWR management plan doesn't give us permission to override NEPA and go do a bunch of projects on, in a wilderness study. We do wonder when that study's scheduled to wrap up. I'm joking, but no, obviously, before we do any kind of habitat improvement or something on federal lands, it's going to go through the NEPA process. We're going to be working with partners. So, maybe there's a way to tweak the language to make sure that's more clearly communicated, but that is the way we do this. And just because it's in our management plan that we want to do something doesn't necessarily give us permission to just go out and do it on federal lands.
Just in comment to that, we have a tremendous working relationship with a monthly meeting or once every 2 months, Miles, I can't remember, with the, all of us, the
monthly.
agencies here in, you know, in a county, but it's just kind of where my only, these RMPs are something new that a lot of the counties have not only finished up in the last 2 or 3 years, you know, have got them finished, so it's something new, and it's something that, you know, may not be a, well, it may not be as far ahead as we are, I'm not sure, but it's just a courtesy. I look at it as more as a courtesy deal.
So I'm just making this motion because Jace did suggest to make these motions instead of just comments. So I fully realize that as a BLM employee, we do coordinate heavily with DWR on all Habitat projects. So it's just a formality, I guess.
So do you want the county RMP language in your motion? Or do you want Brad to make a motion to amend it?
No, it's fine because we all coordinate and collaborate.
So you're including that in your motion?
Yeah, I think it's perfectly
okay.
Fine.
So we have a motion and we have a second by Brad. All in favor?
Aye.
That's unanimous. Thank you. Are there any other?
I've got one more motion in the UNM Mountain unit plan. But I want to preface it just real quick before I make the motion. I did visit with Reg Johnson today from the, he was with the Governor's Public Land Office. He's now with the Department of Agriculture. And he would support the motion I'm going to make for the change just so that the language better coordinates with other state efforts. And that's on the UNM Mountain unit plan, again, under excuse me, potential threats to habitats. In the first paragraph, the second to last sentence, It says, furthermore, the public will be made aware through town councils and other local meetings. We would like to take out in an effort to get local support to reduce. We'd like to take that out and put in the word if. So it would read local meetings if human disturbances to pronghorn and insert becomes an issue. And then we'd like to add a sentence that states that DWR recognizes that there may be circumstances that require increased human activities within pronghorn units to properly manage lands and resources.
Okay, and that's bighorn units, right?
Bighorn units, yes.
Yes.
What did I say?
Pronghorn.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bighorn, yes.
Okay.
Richie, can you read that last sentence again?
Well, and the DWR could tweak this sentence a little bit or, you know, make it, you know what I'm, the gist of what I'm trying to say. So if you needed to tweak it, tweak it. But something to the effect, the DWR recognizes there may be circumstances that require increased human activities within the bighorn unit to properly manage lands and resources.
Okay, we have a motion. Do we have a second?
I second that.
Dick seconds that. We have a motion and a second. I'll call for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, all opposed? That is 8-1. Okay, are there any other motions? Motion passed, 8-1. Are there any other specific motions? Okay, I will entertain a motion to pass the remainder of the plan.
I'll make a motion that we pass the remainder of the presentation, the unit plans, as they were presented by Jace. Dan Abeda.
I'll second that motion, Natasha Haddon.
Okay, all in favor? Okay, that's unanimous.
I've got one thing I forgot to mention before. For the RAC members, there's a new Google group that was created. You may have saw that. Basically, the presentations are now recorded on YouTube through the information packet. And so the division is allowing for people to submit electronic comments. And so those comments could be included into the Google group folder, opportunity to look at those comments and take them into consideration for your decisions. It's going to be an evolving process. This round, we received no comments, no emails. So I suspect that may change later on in some of the other racks. So I just wanted to make the RAC aware of that and to see if you had any feedback.
Mine hasn't worked yet. The server, when you try to get in, it says server.
That will be, we'll just be have the opportunity to listen to them.
Well, you can get online and look at DWR's presentation, but the public comments will be an email comment that comes into that Google group. That way it won't flood your email boxes, but you can go to the Google group and look at those emails. So...
I don't have a comment on that, but before we end, I do have one comment, Chairman, whenever you're ready.
Is it? Go ahead.
It's actually backtracking a little bit on the horse issue with Jamie coming into the meeting. I would like to point out that there were some recent articles come out in the paper, but what wasn't expressed in the paper is the Ute Tribe does recognize they do have an issue with horses. And they have made steps. I know they've gathered some this summer. I know they recently just shipped 60 head that they've gathered and removed from the range. So I think we all recognize there's an issue. And so I don't think that was quite pointed out. And maybe those that were interviewed for the article didn't realize that the tribe has started making steps to remove some of those animals. Thank you.
Thank you. And the article was not accurately written, as opposed as what the Bookcliffs working group presented to the paper, and what came out in the paper was not it was not reflected in our opinion. Let me put it that way. So thank you for the comment, and the group is actually working well with Ute Tribe, and they're a major partner.
I do have a request, though, on your comment. If you could just limit the comment to say that we're what Richie said, but at the same time, we don't. I don't have the authority to give any specifics on numbers or anything that we're giving out. That has to come out from the Tribal Council. Absolutely. So any specifics to numbers or around us have to be permitted by them.
Absolutely. Okay, this meeting is adjourned.
We need a motion.
I do really have to have a motion. Does anybody oppose adjourning this meeting?
No, but I'd make the motion that we had adjourned.
Brad made a motion.
I'll second that.
Okay. Yeah. All in favor. Okay.